Show.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Couple of fairly long broadcast days here at the headquarters of the Head On Radio Network, high in the hills of wonderful West Bicod, Virginia. Thank you very kindly, John Fox. But it's okay. I've got my eyelids propped open with toothpicks, and I've got some fire ants gnawing on my ankles just to sort of keep me sharp and alert. And it is Friday. And that means a couple of different things. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, our weekly conversation with Carolyn Kay of MakeThemAccountable.com. MakeThemAccountable.com. Spell it like it sounds like. Hang .com on the end and go to a website that is by far among the, simply put, the most comprehensive compendia of information that you could possibly want on this society, our political nightmare that we live in, and occasionally some happy stuff too. All kinds of stuff. Close eye on the media, close eye on the political hacks, flacks, and otherwise that somehow find a way to separate us from our hard-earned tax dollars. And so one other thing, also coming up this evening, a conversation with the author of Coal River, a fascinating, fascinating new book that is doing wonders to shed light on the nightmare of mountaintop removal. Michael Schneerson will be joining us in the second hour of the program. But right now, as promised, live from Chicago, as the saying goes, the city that has many names, Carolyn Kay from Make Them Accountable. Caro, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining me for the second week in a row.
Hi, Bob. Nice to be here.
I tell you what, folks responded very well to our conversation last week, and I enjoyed the heck out of it. I hope you
did
as well.
Good, I did too.
Let's see. It's hard to, when you're dealing with the tail end of a long political week, it's hard to know just exactly where to start. Is there anything particularly lighting up your world, anything on the threat board that you feel like is particularly deserving of attention?
Well, I think I'd like to talk a little bit about the differences of opinion that are going on among Democrats that the media are trying to overplay, and that some people are saying will be the death of the Democratic Party and all of this. And I would just like to remind people that, you know, to those of us here in Chicago, politics is not beanbag. And for people to be sniping at each other and, you know, calling attention to bad things in the other person's record, is that's what you do. That's how you beat the other guy. And for some people to say, oh, the Clintons are always picking on other people, or for other people to say, oh, Obama does, you know, this and that. Sorry, that's the way it is. That's the way politics is. That's what people do. And grow up. Everybody, take a breath, and please understand that that's the way things are going to be.
You know, I understand that, Carolyn, but do you draw a distinction between petty sniping and actual differences of opinion about real issues?
Well, of course, it would be good to discuss issues, but, if, you know, strictly speaking, these guys are just not very different on the issues. And you know, I think that's a good thing, actually. And so what else are they going to do except to go back into the records of each other? You know, it's fair for Obama to question Clinton's association with the Rose Law Firm, which I understand was a hotbed of not such great stuff going on. But it's also fair for Clinton then to bring up Obama's association with this land developer who has, you know, followed him throughout his entire career, and now he says it's just a guy I know, you know, things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Never heard of him.
like Kenny who?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And it's equally fair for the Obama campaign to then turn around and show a 17-year-old photograph of the same slumlord standing grinning like a fox eating poop out of a wire brush between the Clintons.
Yes, that's the way these things come to light. And to my mind, these things need to come to light because trust me when I tell you that everything that could possibly have anything to do with either one, whichever candidate becomes the Democratic nominee, is going to go through one hell of a crucible from the Republicans, not to mention a bunch of lies and stuff. But, you know, even those things that have some sort of basis in truth are going to be out there for everybody to see, and best we confront them now and take a look at them and mull them over and say, you know, is this association, does that make that person a candidate that I don't want to vote for or not? You know, people need to make that choice.
Are you at all concerned, Caro, over the fact that this may be a little bit of us doing their opposition research for them?
What do you mean, us?
Us Democrats doing the Republicans' opposition research.
Trust me when I tell you the Republicans have all this stuff in their little computers. Oh, we're not telling them anything they don't know.
Okay, so Macy's not learning anything from Gimbel's on this.
Because they're not ready yet. Okay.
Okay, well, then the next question. Once our internal bickering, and, you know, inter-family squabbles are always much nastier than just arguing with some Joe on the street. And I think that's what makes people hurt so much in this whole debate, because, frankly, I'm disgusted right now. I truly am. Because I'm really, really concerned about some very, very serious issues, and it seems like we're spending all of our time not talking about them and their issues that have been generated by the Republicans. I'd like to spend a little bit more time, Caro, going away hammer and tongs at what the Republican Party has done to us for the last, low, yea, verily, 8 long years and, 20 out of 30.
Well, I agree with you. I think all three candidates would do well to be hitting on those issues. But I believe that they are hitting on those issues when they're doing their stump speeches and things like that. They are drawing distinctions between themselves and the Republicans. But right now, people need to be able to make a distinction among the Democratic candidates so that they can decide who to vote for in the primary. And then every Democrat needs to stand up and hit on Republicans and do it consistently all the time, 24/7. Until the day after the election.
Is there any danger, do you think, Caro, out of the fact that with all the focus we have placed on the presidential candidates and the, if you will, the cult of personality that grows up around that, that we lose sight of the fact that the congressional race is, well, you know, it's a little important, too. Is there any danger of losing focus, do you think?
Well, this happens every 4 years. It's always the presidential election that is looked at above the congressional elections, but that's why we have the DCCC and the DSCC, you know, to be looking after those things, even while the presidential candidates spar with each other.
Do you not see a little bit of nuance or distinction, perhaps? In the fact that this isn't your run-of-the-mill presidential year, and so far as there's no incumbent running, there's no vice president trying to launch from the, launch from office into his own presidency, is this
sure that makes it more of a free-for-all, and but it also gives us the opportunity to really vet the candidates and really look at them and see what they're like when you do have an incumbent or a vice president running. Trying to take a step up, the issues to me are kind of clouded by the fact that that person already has a leg up, you know, the incumbency itself, whether it be as president or as vice president, has already tilted the playing field, and it to me, I just like that kind of politics more than this. I like it when there are lots of people out there and they're slugging it out with each other, and they're each one is doing his best to get his message out and to tone the other guy's message down. I mean, that's what politics is.
Do you get the tired, worn out old white guys who are running for the Republican nomination? Had a little pageant last night in Florida. I don't know if you caught any of it. I only saw excerpts. I'm working when they're yakking. But it was Hillary all night long, as they had a sort of a little love fest. Are they trying to positively reinforce who they want to run against, or do they just think that she, do you think it's a legitimate feeling that she's just a juggernaut?
Well, they know that that Hillary is a lightning rod for their base. And of course that is, those feelings are feelings that have been generated by, propaganda and lies about the Clintons for more than 15 years, spread by the right wing. You know, of course, that, the Reverend, is it Falwell or Robertson? I always got those two mixed up.
Falwell's already in hell, if that helps us make the distinction.
I think it was Robertson. He's the Christian broadcasting.
Yeah, Pat Robertson.
Okay, well, Robertson, I'm thinking maybe it was Falwell, made a film, or somebody made a film.
Oh, the Clinton Chronicles? Yeah, that was largely done, with Falwell's money.
The murderers and drug dealers and all this kind of stuff, and the feelings of hatred and the claim that Hillary is a communist and all this kind of stuff, which, you know, could not be farther from the truth. These are feelings that have been cultivated and stoked and whatever for all this time, you know, because Hillary is a good fundraising tool for them, and she's a motivator for them to get out the base for the vote and stuff like that. And I know that a lot of people say, okay, well, that means we can't have Hillary as our candidate because she's too polarizing. And what I say is, I mean, Hillary's not my favorite candidate by any stretch of the imagination, but here's what that means. If that's the reason why she is rejected as a candidate for the Democratic Party, what that means is that the extreme right-wing crazies are running our party. That's what that means.
That's very interesting you should put it that way, Kara, because I've been looking at it the same way but from an opposite direction, and it feels like the right wing is picking Hillary for us.
Oh, I think that they believe, now bear in mind, these are the same people that kept after Bill Clinton and his personal sex life, okay, after they kept shooting themselves in the foot over that issue, after they had no foot left, but they were still shooting, you know.
Yeah, blasting away at their kneecaps.
Yeah, I mean, they know no bounds. The hatred is just beyond. Just any little criticism of Bush, especially early on, you know, these same people jump down your throat and say, oh, you just hate Bush, you're a Bush hater, you know, and I would write back to these people and say, no, I don't really hate Bush because I won't care about him at all when he's out of office. You, on the other hand, you know, continue to lash out at Bill Clinton, and he's not president anymore. I mean, here's a news.
Yeah, they spent the
you.
First 4 years of the Bush presidency running against Bill Clinton after they'd already stolen the election. So, yeah.
Right.
And that, I guess that's the one thing that drives me craziest, Carolyn, is that this picture they've painted of Hillary as an international whistling card carrying commie liberal. I mean, that just makes me want to handle snakes and drink strychnine. I wish she was too.
I wish she were much more liberal. you know, instead the real criticism of both of the Clintons, and to my mind now, you know, I'm a person who helped put Barack Obama in the Senate, and I think he too is too much of a corporatist, and he likes to kind of be vague in the way he words things, so that each side can take from it what they want. Now, who does that sound like? And and then when people call him on it, then he can deny, oh, I didn't mean the Republicans had good ideas.
Just that they had ideas.
I was just sitting there talking to a Republican paper, newspaper, and all their editors, and said good things.
Yeah,
about
hey, I was just kissing butt, you know.
Good ideas.
Yeah, right. I was just pandering. I'm a politician. Pandering's what I do.
Well, actually, Paul Krugman pointed out that it was Daniel Patrick Moynihan who used that terminology, the party of ideas.
Very true.
And, pardon?
I said very true. Yeah. That...
Yeah. And so what did Obama mean when he applied that to the Republican Party, especially the way he said it? He said it was about in the last 15 years. Well, that didn't include the Reagan era, you know, and he specifically mentioned that Reagan was transformative in a way that Nixon was not, and that Bill Clinton was not. Now, excuse me, if that ain't mudslinging, I don't know what is.
Precisely. That seems a little bit like that's a bit of a shot across the bow.
Yeah.
And
the Clintons took it up. I say rightfully so, you know.
Well, anybody who ever saw the War Room about the 92 campaign understands that the Clintons, first and foremost, will never, never let a charge go unanswered.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I do have to say this, that Bill Clinton himself never got involved in the head-to-head stuff, okay, as I recall.
His surrogates did it for him for the most part.
He would get people to do it for him, people like Sid Blumenthal and folks like that. And but here he is stepping right into the fray, and I have to tell you, I find it kind of touching. You know, a lot of people say, oh, to have an ex-president doing this and that, and, well, you know, that could be Obama campaign hype for all I know. All I know is here he is standing up for, because Bill Clinton is a codependent, you know, he always wants to be liked by everybody, but here he is standing up for his wife in a way that he never stood up for himself, and I'm touched.
You know, I haven't heard it put that way, but that makes a considerable amount of sense, because you were indirectly responsible for at least one little hissy I had on the air last night, and that was the fact that I got up yesterday morning and I opened up your digest email, and there it is, Citizens United, not timid. And I sat here with my mouth hanging open, catching flies for about 15 seconds.
But here's the thing, though. That if anybody thinks that it's just Hillary that is, you know, is going to be polarizing, they have not learned anything from the last 20 years of Republican viciousness. Okay, because whoever is the Democratic candidate, they're going to come after full bore, both barrels, whichever way they can, just as they did with Kerry. You know, they went after his strength. They got these veterans from Vietnam to say he didn't earn his medals, that he was, you know, the worst kind of thing that could be said about a veteran, especially a heroic veteran, and Kerry was heroic. And they were passing around in Arkansas. They were sending out flyers that if the Democrats won, they were going to take their Bibles away.
They sent it in West Virginia too. That was the only two states. Yeah, yeah.
So here's the thing, folks. Wake up. It's not just Hillary. Believe me, if Obama is the candidate, there is going to be hellacious racial stuff. If you think you haven't seen racial stuff.
Oh, I came up, I said last night that in case anybody thought that it was just Hillary, that Roger Stone probably already had the paperwork for another 527 ready to go in with a vastly different acronym, but equally
yes.
as hateful.
Oh, yes, L-Y-N-C-H or something.
Well, mine was National Independent Group Gathering Equality Racially. You know, because they're that sleazy. And you bring up another point as well, I believe. And it again, I want to reiterate, I am no Hillarista. Okay, I never have been, because I want somebody that's
well,
got
that's
some
a good thing, because you would be a wimp if you were.
Oh God, oh God. but
would be a castrato.
Yes, I would. Yeah, thank you, Chris Matthews. Singing in the castrato choir, right? the thing that bears remembering is if and one of the memes that I do find very, very disturbing lately is that and I'm guilty of it. Okay, sometimes I sit down and I say it's all wrestling, and
yeah.
on Friday night the blue mask wins, and on Saturday night the red mask wins, and on Sunday afternoon they have brunch together.
Oh, I think there's a big difference though.
Well, there is a significant difference, and what I'm getting at is that that thing has gained a lot of traction, and to that extent, it's worth noting, if there was no difference between the two, why would you have 527 groups already forming like that hateful piece of crap, if there was nothing at stake in this election and it really didn't matter who won or who lost? I'm reminded of 2000 again. And that assertion that there's not a dime's bit of difference between a Democrat and a Republican.
And I think
have we learned
how the last 7 years would be different if Al Gore had prevailed? We know he was elected, but
I have dreams about that. Prevailed. I really do. I dream about what America would have been had we had Al Gore at the helm. I can imagine.
Bear in mind that all that vitriol that the right wing had for Hillary and Bill Clinton was just transferred to Al Gore, if you remember. That
sure.
was when I started getting involved in politics, was in the summer of 2000, when I would go to these message boards on the internet, and the things they were saying about Al Gore were absolutely atrocious and hateful and mean and all of this. You know, it was like the genie was let out of the bottle, and it got to me. There was a lot of racial stuff in it. There was a lot of misogynist stuff in there. And it's like these people, yeah, I kept thinking that if Bush prevails, these people are only going to get more bold. Guess what?
Yeah.
He did prevail.
And they did get more bold. Absolutely. Now, let me ask you this. Some dummy forgot to turn the ringer off, and that would be me. this thing will be done in a second. But anyway, one of the things that does disturb me about our two Democratic candidates is the fact that...
And there are three.
Yes, there are. Shame on me. slap me at a distance, please. But one of the things that disturbs me, and, well, the reason I said two is because of Senator Clinton and Senator Obama. I'm not a single-issue voter, but I have a single issue that is closer to me probably in terms of physical proximity than most people even listening to this program, and that is the war on Appalachia via mountaintop removal. It has effects that go out all from sea to shining sea, but it's happening here, and I'm greatly disturbed by the fact that both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have touted the miracle of clean coal technology and said that they think that coal to liquid technology is just the bee's knees.
Yeah.
And so that does feed into that sense of helplessness for people for whom that issue is very, very profound, because it looks like whether you get McCain or Giuliani or Huckabee or Hillary or Obama, they're all for clean coal technology and turning coal into liquids, and the only person out there that has said without a doubt that he is opposed to it is John Edwards. So I know where that leaves me standing.
Yeah, and Edwards is actually my favorite of these three candidates that are left. I love Kucinich, and you know, I think it's a damn shame that he couldn't have gained more traction. But of the three, And someone asked me yesterday, they said, well, Edwards is just as corporate as the other two, and he voted for the war. Well, of course, that vote, that Iraq resolution vote, really wasn't a vote for the war, strictly speaking, although they should have known better. But the difference between Edwards and the other two is that he has unequivocally renounced those positions.
As well as his yay vote on the bankruptcy bill.
Yes, yes.
And also, there's a little bit of a flavor in that of closing the barn door after the horse is gone.
I understand that, but as strongly as he has said that his allegiance is to help the poor and working people, which of course any sane person would realize helps the entire country. I mean, if they just sat down and thought about it for half a second, and would help the CEOs too, would help raise the stock prices and therefore their stock options, and they'd make more money and all of that, but they're all against him, and they raised hundreds of millions of dollars just in case they have to beat him to a bloody pulp.
And that sort of plays back into what we were just talking about a couple of minutes ago, about who they want to run against and who they don't want to run against, and the manipulation of the media, and the marginalization of John Edwards is ample proof that they have no interest in running against him. It is somewhat reminiscent to me of the taking out and thrashing of Howard Dean in 2004.
Yes.
Because
yes.
It was clear that the Republican Party wanted no part of somebody the similarities are quite stunning, because they wanted no part of a person who had a legitimate populist message to offer the United States.
Right, exactly.
And so in both cases, you know, bye-bye, we're going to pretend you're not there. You can talk, but we're turning your microphone off.
That's right.
So now you've let me move us in a slightly different direction. You referenced this idea of, you know, helping the poor. I think it's a sad commentary on the people of the United States that message has apparently not resonated at all with hardly anyone. And as a consequence, you see the flavor of the so-called stimulus package coming out of Congress. What are you reading about that?
About the stimulus package?
Yeah.
Well, my favorite economist, Paul Krugman, says it's not going to do anything. It's not going to be a stimulus. And it's not going to help the people that really need the help.
The people that need the help are the people who can't keep the lights on right now.
That's right.
Who can't buy food.
Yeah.
Talked about it at length last night. The people who would immediately turn that back into real economic stimulus inside individual communities are people who don't have any money right now at all.
Right, but you see, if we help those people that expect us to help them again, that's the problem. It's a moral hazard. If you help people, they're gonna be dependent on you forever and ever for the rest of their days and for the rest of their children's days and their children's children's days, and therefore you can't help them.
I loathe.
Even though it would be good for all of us to help them.
Yeah, I loathe the people who think like that. I heard some of that on Guy James's show earlier today, and just, you know, sitting here getting another bruised big toe because I was kicking the desk.
Here's the thing that really gets to me is I sent you some links during the week, and it gets back to these families, the funding families.
Exactly. Yeah, I read that stuff.
And the Koch and the Coors and the Scapes and the, you know, all these people, Olin's. That decided that they wanted America to be a right-wing country, you know. And so they have funded a propaganda campaign that has been going on for more than 35 years to help Americans, you know, go for their greed side. You know, I'm of the opinion that we have dueling needs as human beings. We have a need to be selfish, and we also have a need to be altruistic. It's built in. There's an altruistic tendency that's built in.
Yeah, above and outside of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, there's what you're talking about. A need.
It's a duality of human nature, because we are social beings. Our success as animals, as living things, has to do with living in groups. And therefore, there's a need, built-in need to work with the group, cooperate with the group, be part of the group. And, but that is the part that these people have been trying to get us to deny. They're trying to get us to deny half of our nature. You know, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, you know.
No.
It took me a long time to reach the stage in my own life where I was able to say, hey, I think I need balance between those two. Yes, I need some selfishness, but yes, I need this other side too, you know. And but in the name of rich people keeping everything that they can grab, steal, and whatever, and not feel guilty about it, they've spent a lot of that money instead of on taxes. And instead of on things that would help the entire economy, building this network of stink tanks, I call them, and media outlets and whatever, that preach the gospel of greed, greed, greed. It's amazing how they've managed to convince people against the teachings of every major religion. And yet they've managed to convert an awful lot of Americans.
And to the fiscal religion, I guess would be as good a way to describe it as anything else. Well, I tell you, that was a real eye opener reading about the founding fathers, but the funding families.
The funding families.
And I came away from it, Carolyn. One, you know, just all I could see out of it was that. It was the power of large sums of aggregated money, and I guess that at the in the final analysis is one of our fundamental problems. We have so many issues on the liberal progressive side, and every last issue has representatives behind it with their hands out, including this network, that we are hard-pressed to aggregate it, and by being unable to aggregate it, it leaves us rather behind the eight ball in terms of enunciating a core philosophy. Make any sense?
Oh, it certainly does. And it's not even the core philosophy, just the idea that there are many, many voices spreading the word for what we believe and for what we understand, the way we understand the world to work, you know. And the fact that on their side, so many people are paid to be making up all this stuff about their side, and on our side, you know, way too many people are doing it for the love of the cause, and are not paid to do it, and therefore have to make their living in other ways or starve to death, as the case may be. It's really a pitiful situation. It's pitiful, pitiful, pitiful that the top people, the people who could make it happen on our side, refuse to see the need. It could happen one of two ways or a combination of the two. There are very rich people on our side, and there are a lot of people on our side. So it could come from small donations from a lot of people, and or it could come from big donations from people that can afford those, you know, the big donations. But and part of it is wrapped up with what we talked about last week in terms of the consultant class of for political campaigns. It's in their best interest to keep anybody else from having any kind of power over the message or the candidates or the whatever, okay? So they're going to steer the big donors as best they can away from that kind of effort for their own personal needs, their own personal gains. They believe, just as, you know, just as Republicans do, in power only and not what's good or right or best for most people. Sad to say.
Very sad. Do you remember a couple of years ago there was a Washington Post story about a group of righteously wealthy liberal funders and donors who had gotten together and created a group, and they were going to fund liberal causes?
Oh, yes.
But it was
the Alliance for Democracy.
Was that it? Don't call us, we'll call you. It was sort of like the A-Team. If you needed them, they'd find you.
Well, as I understood it, you were supposed to send them proposals, but of course they never got back to anybody except the same usual suspects, Media Matters for America, the Center for American Progress, the ones that are controlled by the same consultant class. You know, I mean, it's just, it's really bothersome. The guy that started that, Rob Stein, when I first read about him and his efforts, he knew exactly what you and I are talking about right now. And he understood exactly what needed to be done. But by the time the donors got together and started actually putting money into the thing, it had been diverted away from media and back into, research, which is important, you know. American Progress does important work. Media Matters for America does important work. No question about it. But they shouldn't be the only ones.
Well, unless they're going to start their own newspaper and start their own radio network and start their own TV project, they're hard-pressed to get their message out without someone, because as silly as it may seem and as much of a fool as I may occasionally make of myself, Caro, this is not a hobby.
Yeah.
And it's not a hobby for anybody on the liberal side who's trying to do what we're doing here. And it takes, I'm sitting here just furiously patting myself on the back. it takes a lot of go-get to crawl in behind the microphone night after night after night. I mean, you can ask anybody on this network who wasn't doing this and said, "Hey, I think I'd like to try my hand at doing a show." Because, you know, about 2 months in, the reality begins to set in that this is your life.
Yeah.
And so, with all due respect to the fine work that these organizations that you just mentioned do, and I sincerely mean they do fine work. We've had folks from Center for American Progress and Media Matters on this program a number of times, and they never come on but what they just really, really lay out the information. They never mail it in. They've always got their facts straight, and they are a resource of inestimable value. But the resource has to have a means of getting out there, doesn't it?
That's right. It has to have a microphone.
So it seems like perhaps maybe one of the best ways of describing this is to say that we have a rather institutional case of ADD, don't we?
Well, I think that we have some entrenched powers that that need to be chipped away at. Sadly, I wish I could just magically make these people see things the way I do. But little bit by little bit, I just found out about an organization that is going to be spending a good bit of money on an effort over the next few months to make sure that Bush's approval ratings don't rise before the next election. And, you know, in other words, what they're going to, I'm not sure that that's the best intent to have, but, they're going to spend, a lot of effort and presumably money making sure that the media is bombarded with the lies, let's don't forget what's been done here. Let's don't forget the, abrogation of the Constitution, the this, the that, the that, the that, the that, the that. So they're going to be doing reminder after reminder after reminder. And that made me think, okay, they almost get it.
Getting close. Warmer. Yes, warmer.
That all needs to be done. But, I'm trying to get in touch with somebody with that organization so that I can point out to them, but here's what you're doing. And this is what I try to tell MOVE on the same thing. When you raise money, and with candidates, you raise money to spend on advertising, What you are doing is putting money in the pockets of the very media moguls who pay their employees so extremely well, hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars a year, to always say bad things about Democrats and always say good things about Republicans.
Amen, Sister Carol.
For our own destruction.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing, and the other side of that is there is a wall. And so, not to denigrate the efforts that you just described, because they are efforts that must be made, but I'm reminded of the story that came out, what, 2-3 days ago, about the 935 uncontrovertible documented lies told by George Bush and his buddies to get us into the Iraq War. Are you aware of where that wound up on the Washington Post?
I don't know if it hit the Washington Post. It did hit the Associated Press and, you know, a lot of the news services. But
something like page 17, I think. You know, right below the obituaries and nowhere near the Sudoku. So, you know, people who go to do the puzzles can't even find it.
The Washington Post knows what's important.
Well, yes, they do, because, you know, they wouldn't be highly paid professional media if they didn't. We're so, which reminds me, another thing that I, speaking of the professional media, we're taking bets here, Caro. Whose voice was it whispering the answer to Willard Romney last night?
Oh, I wish I knew. I mean, that is so difficult. That is what we need, is another empty suit. Needs an earpiece.
I don't know if people know about this. I assume that earpiece gate has gotten around now. But I've got the best audio I could find of it, and it's a short clip, and you and I can share the enjoyment of it together.
Oh, yes, play it.
And share it with the folks sharing their time with us. Now, just by way of explaining to you, and because you probably already heard it, I usually tell people I have not monkeyed with this audio in any way. Well, in this case, I have, because what you're going to hear is a question asked of Mitt Romney. And then before Mitt Romney answers, you're going to hear a whispered, a whispered piece of advice. And I have gone in, and it's not the best quality, but I have gone in and boosted that whisper as much as I possibly can.
Yeah, you almost have to, because it's difficult to hear. Go do it.
Okay, here we go.
Governor Romney, you are a big fan of Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. Will you do for Social Security what Ronald Reagan did in 1983?
I'm not going to raise taxes. What I'm going to do is...
Well, Ronald Reagan...
It's tough to make out. I guess it's kind of like a shadow on the grassy knoll.
Well, it's on YouTube also, and there's a link to it at Make Them Accountable in today's media section. So if anybody wants to go at it from there. But, you know, Bush may not even have been the first to have this kind of whispering assistance. You know, there are a lot of us who question whether Ronald Reagan really needed a hearing aid.
Oh, yeah, right. And it's worth remembering, though, because when the George Bush story broke, it broke because a rocket scientist,
yes,
who had spent his career doing optical examinations of the surface of Mars, among other places.
Right.
I think he was one of the ones who said, "No, that is not Elvis's face." he saw the pictures of Bush, and he saw the little square box on Bush's back. And
I believe people had raised the question before that, and when he saw the questions, and then he saw the pictures, that's when he said, "Okay, well, let me apply my topographical formulas to this thing." And he said, "Oh, that's a booster."
Yeah, that's a something.
Somebody's feeding him audio.
And as a and the New York, and this was always the fun part, you know, the professional media fun part. The New York Times was ready to run with it, and at the last minute, it got quashed.
Yep.
Because it wouldn't be fair. And then immediately George Bush's handlers came out and said, "Well, we've talked to his tailor, Georges de Paris, and he says it's a wrinkle in the $10,000 suit."
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
That's a puckered stitch. You know, I knitted instead of purling.
Oh, we're doing a hunchback. Didn't we tell you that?
Yeah. so you know, this raises that back up. But I'm gonna ask. Well, he's in the chat room right now. Our audio engineer extraordinaire, John Fox. I'd love to have his opinion on what it is, because is it, how did it get out? Because was it somebody whispering into a microphone, or did the earbox bleed, or did somehow or another the frequency of the wireless transmission suddenly get picked up? But it's there. It wasn't so clear when I played it, and I apologize, but it's there, and the person clearly says, when Tim Russert asks, will you do for Social Security what Ronald Reagan did? And you can, and when you're watching the video, you can sort of see Willard Romney get that deer in the headlights look.
Duh.
And suddenly this little voice of God says, raise taxes. You know, I don't know. The next debate, Caro, I expect Rosebud.
Oh, yeah, well, something like that.
But who was it? You know, I mean, people are saying, was it Russert? And I can't imagine, but...
It couldn't possibly have been any of the other candidates, because they would love nothing better than for him to fall flat on his face. And I don't know that Russert would have even occurred to him. He was so far away, I don't know. You know how in plays they sometimes have a person...
The prompter.
Prompter. Prompter. There you go. They have somebody kind of hidden that can throw lines to the people. You know, maybe they each had one. I don't know. McCain admitted that he doesn't know anything about economics, so surely he had a prompter for economics.
Oh, but there's so many things he doesn't know about. Why did he pick economics? He doesn't know that it might not be a good idea for the economy to be in Iraq for 100 years either.
I know.
Oh, and by the way, just keeping up with this week's news, I know you had to just sort of giggle quietly to yourself when you saw that Joe Mendham Lieberman has been made an official part of Team McCain.
No, I was very surprised.
Were you really?
No.
Okay. See, this is radio. Sometimes it makes irony a little difficult.
No, I think Lieberman is angling for some kind of position. I think he realizes his days are numbered as a senator in Connecticut. Unfortunately, the blogosphere did not do a very good job of following through once it had unseated him as the Democratic nominee for senator in Connecticut. They just dropped Ned Lamont like a hot potato, which, if they'd been really serious about the situation, they would have kept on working for Lamont and gotten him elected. But you know, they didn't have the.
Well, do you have Caro's little crystal ball handy? Can you imagine the following words: McCain Lieberman.
I don't know that. That McCain would even want him. I see Lieberman more. He and I think he probably sees himself more as Secretary of Defense or Secretary of State. I mean, it's kind of like American Idol, you know.
So
with these horrible voices, and they just think they're the cat's meow. They're just the greatest of the great. You know, that's what Lieberman reminds me of.
So where the Bush administration has had an open door policy for AIPAC in the State Department, Joe Lieberman will just go ahead and hang the sign.
Yes, yeah. AIPAC at work here.
Yeah, right. Your tax dollars at work supporting AIPAC.
Yeah.
Oh my God! It has been a very, very interesting week, Caro, and I appreciate you taking time to join us for these little Friday soirees. They certainly are fun for me.
Well, it's great fun for me as well.
Is there anything that was on the radar that somehow we managed to miss or dodge or evade?
I think there's at least one thing that we need to be paying attention to on the more technical side, and that is, you know, the media content delivery side, and that is that Google has been cleared to buy some of the bandwidth. bandwidth spectrum that is going to be freed up when all broadcast television goes from analog to digital. So the analog signal takes up so much space it's so much width in the spectrum that when they go digital, so much less will be needed for each station, that there's going to be a lot of bandwidth freed up. And one of the possibilities for that bandwidth is that it could be used for cell phones, and Google may be getting into the business of not providing the phones, but they do have a software platform for mobile phones that also delivers internet and so on. In other words, what I'm trying to get at is there's going to be a marriage of all of this. There's going to be people are going to use one source for their telephone, internet, receipt of content of all sorts, whether it be news, entertainment, whatever. That's all going to be married all together and mixed all together, and it's pretty much going to be internet based.
And if so, so it might be Google going up against the AT&T's, the Verizon's.
Oh, they will be.
Yeah.
If Google truly is bidding for some of that spectrum, yes.
Well, is there any truth before we wrap up? Speaking of Google, have you? I was reading Mark Morford the other day, and I love Mark Morford.
I do too.
But he referenced the rumblings that Google might be interested in the New York Times.
I don't know if he made that up or not, but some of the journalism pundits did kind of take that up and said, well, it would give the New York Times some needed cash and technology, perhaps, to go up against Rupert Murdoch, because with Murdoch owning the Wall Street Journal now and becoming almost respectable. And having bought MySpace, and so, I mean, he's becoming a real techno company for delivery of media content and advertising too. I mean, all of that is tied together, and this is another thing that we need to be careful about as progressives, that if, you know, nobody wants to pay for any content on the internet, and of course they don't really want to get ads either, but somebody's got to pay for it. Okay, so right now, what everybody's looking at is that ads are the way to fund everything, okay?
Yeah.
The problem with that, as I see it, is that puts those same big corporations in charge. You know, they pull the strings. They say, we're not going to pay for this kind of content or that kind of content.
Well, that's the very conversation that we started down last night on the show that rolls at 11 p.m., the Horn Section. And that is that the goal of these big media companies is to take out the bilateral or multilateral nature of the internet and replace it with a model that is sickeningly similar to television, in which they decide and you sit and receive.
Yes. Yes. And was very much like the old AOL days.
Oh, you know, that word is forbidden on this network. Because I was a telemarketer once, and I've actually.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, and I've got a reservation in hell for talking people into taking AOL.
Well, but there was a time when AOL, when it was a bulletin board before it really integrated with the internet, there was a time when it was a great service. You know, you had your email, you had these forums where that was the social network, and that was, you know. People played games and.
God, that seems so long ago. I think that was when I rode to the store on my dinosaur to buy the first computer.
That may have been. When the internet came along, and at that time I was a CompuServe subscriber because I'm a technical person, and that's where the forums were for doing programming. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So on CompuServe. And it also was a bulletin board. But as the internet came along and more companies began putting their support and their discussion groups and all of that onto their own websites, as opposed to, they didn't need CompuServe anymore and they didn't need AOL. And so much as they fought against it, but of course MSN was founded right at the time when they thought they were going to capture some of that kind of market, and Microsoft has said for years that it wanted to get back to that kind of situation where you have to pay a toll to get on the internet, not just for your physical access, but for content as well, and that they control the content. Everybody wants to control the content. And what's going to happen is by default is going to be controlled by advertisers, unless we get smarter about getting ordinary people involved and getting one of the things that I've recommended is that we start a subscription service where people just pay a few dollars a month, but if it's a lot of people, there we can support a lot of different media, and then we start to have the control over content. And if some advertiser says you can't do this, and then we can come back and say, well, our subscribers want you to do it,
And they're X billion strong, exactly.
So I don't know, but as I've said before, my middle name should be Cassandra, and. Because I see it so clearly, and other people don't seem to see it. So,
well,
one of these days I'm going to be able to say, I told you so.
Cold comfort, mighty cold comfort.
Oh,
have a wonderful weekend, Carolyn, and
you too.
I look forward to next Friday.
Too.
Thank you, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Very good.
All right, bye now. Carolyn Kay of MakeThemAccountable.com. I'm getting kind of fond of these little conversations on Friday evening. If you're on hold, please take note. We've got a guest coming up, Michael Schneerson, author of Coal River. I think you want to hear what he has to say, my guess is, because he has done as good a job, and frankly a better job than most, of explaining to people outside of Appalachia what mountaintop removal really, really means. And he will be on post-haste. In the meantime, a little offering from a newly released album from my favorite band, the Drive-By Truckers. Just something to carry us into the top of the hour. Name of the album, Brighter Than Creation's Dark. The song, The Home Front. This is The Horn. We'll be right back. I'm Bob Kincaid.
It's your second hour in the liberal sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Yes, indeedy. About 1 minute past the hour of 7 p.m. here on the East Coast. One after four on the West Coast. And 1 minute after 11 down in Sydney, Australia. I'm like one of those clocks, one of those little displays on the wall that had, you know, the time in seven or eight different time zones. God only knows what time it is if you're listening to this on a podcast, however. This is new media. This is 21st century media. And you know what? You have the power. You can listen when you want to. And we kind of like it that way, too. Makes it kind of fun when we've got the rerun stream going on the weekend and people call in and just want to have a conversation. And you know what? Most of the time I do, just because I dig talking to people. Let's see. Now, as I promised you a couple of minutes ago, we have on the line with us author Michael Schneerson. He is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair magazine and an author of a couple of books, not the least of which is a book called The Car That Could, a fascinating account of the electric car. But most recently, through the publisher Farrah Straus and Giroux, he has released a book entitled simply Coal River. Brand new out, Coal River. It was excerpted in the, chapter one was excerpted in the New York Times last week. And if you haven't read that, well, why mess around? Just go over to the store at headonradionetwork.com and order a copy that way. Because if you want to know, and I talk about this issue constantly, I'm proud to be one of the first people who did it on a national or global basis, on a regular basis. But Michael Schneerson has taken it and deconstructed it and taken a scalpel to it and shown what a horror it is on virtually every level imaginable. So with that in mind, I'm proud to have with us on the show tonight, Michael Schneerson. Michael, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Bob. Good evening. Thanks for having me.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Tell us first of all how you came to decide to take a run at this topic.
Well, I'm a New Yorker, Bob, and I'd never even been to West Virginia, much less heard of mountaintop removal mining. But I'm a writer for Vanity Fair magazine, and some years back I decided to do what actually was the magazine's first real environmental story in 2003 on the Interior Department in the George W. Bush administration. And you probably know Interior oversees all the public lands, and it sets a lot of environmental policies, and it was setting them all the wrong way. So I did an overview there, but the policy that really haunted me just from hearing about it was this mountaintop mining. So when that story came out, I then went down on my own to southern West Virginia to the coal fields, and I'll tell you how naive I was. I thought the coal fields were fields. I didn't realize that, it was very jagged in this topography down there. And I also didn't really know what to expect in the Coal River Valley. I sort of had these images in my head of, Walker Evans photographs of, miners in their overalls with, dirt smudged faces, and it was a revelation to me that it was this beautiful sylvan area. But when I got up in a little plane and looked overhead at what was going on a couple ridges over, I saw exactly what mountaintop mining was, and I realized that this was a story I had to tell.
How long were you gathering evidence and gathering information for the book?
Well, I felt from the start, Bob, that what I really wanted to do, if I was going to get this word out, it had to be a story. I mean, if you just write a, sort of earnest nonfiction environmental book about mountaintop mining, you're only preaching to the converted. There's really no point in that. I realized, though, early on that I had some great characters, one of them was the environmental lawyer Joe Lovett.
Mm-hmm.
know, brilliant lawsuits. We're trying to stop this at the highest level. And Judy Bonds, of course, and the rest of Cold River Mountain Watch were remarkably articulate and charismatic. And it was on that first trip also that I heard about Don Blankenship and realized that my tale had a villain.
Yeah, sort of like sitting in the movie theater the first time you hear the Darth Vader theme, isn't it?
Sort of is. I mean, he was really, the stories about Don were almost too much to believe. It was, you know, I mean, as a human being, I was sort of horrified by the aggressiveness with which he was trying to lop off these mountaintops and, you know, parenthetically break the Union in every mine he bought. But as a writer, I have to say I was sort of fascinated. I thought, who is this guy? And it's funny, you know, one reviewer has since said that in a way Don steals the story because he's, you know, in a sort of dark way, the most fascinating character of all.
Well, Mephistopheles is always the more fascinating character in Dr. Faustus, too.
Isn't
so
it? Yeah.
So, anyway,
I started with these characters, but, you know, one thing maybe important to say is that I didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, this was the spring of 2004. I just started following this. I knew that Joe was pursuing yet another lawsuit against the Army Corps of Engineers. I knew Judy was cranking up to publicize the plight of the Marsh Fork Elementary School. And I knew Don wanted to, you know, blast some more mountains. But I really didn't know what was going to happen. And I'm not sure I would ever write this kind of book again because it really was a gamble. I had to hope that dramatic things would happen. But, you know, much like a novelist watching his characters sort of lead the way, I watched these three characters all do incredibly dramatic things in the last 3 years.
Now, obviously, you've made it clear sort of which side you stand on in this issue. But Michael, did you discover any nuance to the argument? Or is it as black and white as people like Judy Bonds and Larry Gibson and everybody associated as we those of us who are horrified by it? Is it as black and white as we see it?
Well, that's a very good question, Bob. I mean, you know, certainly when the coal industry talks about mountaintop mining as being the most efficient way to get the coal in this region generally, especially with thinner seams of coal, I mean, that's true. You know, if you're just looking at things from a capitalistic point of view, it's a heck of a lot more efficient to put a few people on top of a mountain and blow the mountaintop and, you know, scrape the seam than it is to put hundreds of people down in an underground mine. There's really no argument there. And then Massey will say, you know, look, we're in competition with other coal companies, Arch, Consol, Peabody, and we're all in competition with, you know, Western mines, and we're all in competition with China. And, you know, that's true as far as it goes. But really, you know, at the end of the day, when you've destroyed all the mountains, the purple mountain majesty, if you will, of America, who cares if it was more efficient financially? Clearly, what needs to be done is for state and federal government to get in there and change the playing field, you know, provide incentives or disincentives so that it's not the most efficient way to do it.
What kind of reception have you been met with outside Appalachia, Michael? Because it does seem to be a localized issue. And that's why we work so hard to publicize it.
Well, as I go around talking about this and you know, appearing on national shows, I mean, just yesterday I was on the Diane Rehm show, which broadcasts out of Washington, and she's just this lovely, incredibly informed, radio talk show host who'd never heard of mountaintop mining, and she was horrified by what we told her. Actually, Joe and Judy got on the air with me. I think most people outside Appalachia have never heard of it. In fact, you know, ironically, Joe Lovett himself grew up in Charleston, and he'd never heard of it before his first day as an environmental lawyer when someone brought pictures to him and said, look what's happening to my neighborhood. So, you know, there's a tremendous job of education that still needs to be done, you know, even sadly, in parts of West Virginia, but certainly beyond. And, you know, the tragedy is that this area is cut off not only geographically, well, of course, that's a great part of its beauty, but it is cut off geographically. It's also cut off socioeconomically. I mean, as I say in the book, this would never happen in, you know, Connecticut, where you got a lot of rich people who would just rise up and make it stop.
Is that what it is? Is it fundamentally an economic justice issue then?
Sure, I think it's as much that as anything. I mean, you know, starting with the economic injustice of the fact that these coal companies 100 years ago, or timber companies, land companies, whatever, however they were configured then, bought up all this land for pennies, literally, you know, sometimes buying people's mineral rights for a hog. And the injustice starts there, and that continues because these companies, like the Roland Land Company, still own 90% of the land down in the coal fields. You know, it's also economic injustice because these are powerful companies which politically can have their way in a state where, you know, the governor on down is pretty much beholden to the industry. And I think another aspect of economic injustice, and I say this in the book, is that, you know, decades passed, when there were coal booms, and of course it was underground coal, it wasn't that hard to start up a little operation. You know, you had mom and pop operations. You know, an ordinary working man could hope to make a small fortune. That doesn't happen now because so much of the mining is mountaintop mining, and it's hugely capital intensive. So that's for big companies, not little operators.
So during the time that you spent here, Michael, you've mentioned politics in this state, and you sort of, I mean, that's a broad brush stroke, but does it appear to you that this is a bought and paid for government in this state? I mean, you know, most places it'll you know, you see some state senator's name, it'll say R and the name of the county, or D and the name of the county. We get a sense here that it's all just D coal or R coal. I mean,
Bob, I got the same sense in my reporting, and I say in the book that, you know, King Cole has really never much cared whether lawmakers were Republicans or Democrats. I mean, you know, Manchin came in as governor as a Democrat, saying some of the right things, you know, expressing concerns. And of course, when the terrible tragedy at Sago occurred, he was there preaching the need for greater safety measures, and it was a remarkable moment after, I think, the third and fourth death that came right after that. He said, "We are stopping every, you know, coal mine in this state until we do a thorough safety measure." And standing right next to him was Bill Rainey of the West Virginia Coal Association, a lobbying group, you know. And you could sort of see what Rainey winced. And someone asked, "Well, how long is that going to take, Governor?" And, you know, Rainey kind of looked at him, and the governor said, "Well, you know, it'd take an hour, maybe two." So, and in fact,
thoroughly useless.
A thorough safety check of all mines in an hour or two. And even Senator Byrd expressed astonishment at that. But sadly, Byrd, who is, of course, also a Democrat, and Rockefeller, who's a Democrat, they have lined up staunchly behind the coal industry their whole careers, and I'm sure it would be said that, you know, they wouldn't be there without the industry.
Well, the first time Jay Rockefeller ran for governor here, I believe, he said that strip mining should be abolished,
mm-hmm.
and he had his rear end handed to him, and he has never uttered that phrase again.
I heard that story, and someone sent me a transcript of a recent talk he gave to the industry, and it just couldn't have been cozier and more supportive. And, you know, I thought maybe Byrd, when he got into his ninth and presumably final term of office, you know, becoming the longest running senator in U.S. history, and having done some impressive things, let's not forget he was the first senator to stand up and give a speech against the impending Iraq war. But, you know, I thought, okay, finally, you know, he's not beholden to the industry anymore. he had had this dramatic meeting with Ed Wiley, you know, a member of Colorado Mountain Watch.
Right.
As many of your listeners probably know, walked all the way from his home in West Virginia to Washington to meet with Byrd. Byrd expressed great sympathy for the situation with the Marsh Park Elementary School and the coal prep plant behind it. But you know what, Bob? That was more than a year ago, and Byrd has won his ninth term, and nothing's happened.
And there is still no ground broken on a new school for the Marsh Fork students. They're still going to school in filth.
Yeah, and I think what Byrd's rationale finally was that it was, well, it was a county issue. The county Board of Education had to ask for a new school, and they hadn't asked for one, which gets into local politics because there are, you know, a lot of teachers and managers at the school resent this whole effort on the part of Colorado Mountain Watch to make an issue of it. They like the school just where it is. They feel that it's safe in the shadow of that impoundment, and they don't want a new school. So apparently Byrd couldn't override that.
And, of course, you know, and it's not just Senator Byrd and Senator Rockefeller. It's the entire House of Representatives delegation as well. Mountaintop removal has recently expanded into the area where I live and where we broadcast from. If this show was on 2 hours earlier, I could hang a microphone out the window and you could hear the sounds of the bombing.
Where exactly are you?
We're about 50 miles east of Charleston on US 60. It's the plateau area of Fayette County. We're in the literally in the heart of the whitewater rafting industry. They started destroying a mountain that's about 2 miles as the crow flies from the New River Gorge National River.
Well, you know, you just hit on another tragic aspect of this. I mean, the short-sightedness of it is just astonishing. I mean, not only are we destroying these millennially old mountains for, you know, tomorrow's coal, which becomes next week's, you know, air pollution and water pollution and mercury pollution, but, you know, we're destroying the opportunity to have a tourism business, an environmental tourism business. You know, it's true that whitewater rafting may not bring as much money into the pockets of West Virginians as coal mining, and you know, one is always up against that. The industry is the dominant one; it pays by far the most money. But I heard an interesting theory from a prospective congressman in Kentucky, actually a Democrat, who said, and this wouldn't necessarily please all your listeners, but he said, you know, there's bear hunting in West Virginia, or maybe it's Kentucky, and rich people pay lots of money to do that. What if we organized something so that, you know, some guy would pay $30,000 to be guided into the woods and hunt there? Well, you know, people may be against that sort of hunting, but commercial hunting on that level could be extremely profitable, and it's just, you know, an interesting creative way that you could actually make money from these hills without blasting them to smithereens.
Well, exactly, and I apologize because I'm slightly behind the eight ball in that I have not gotten my hands on the book yet. But are you aware, Michael, of the fight over the windmills in this state?
You know, I'm not actually. No.
Well, it's a fascinating sort of sidebar to what you just mentioned about the hunting issue. Down in Greenbrier County, where the blasting is echoing toward me, is beginning on the western end of that county. There is a plan that will create like 500, you know, good prevailing wage scale jobs and put up a windmill farm out of sight of everybody.
Oh.
And generate a ton of electricity. And lo and behold, the environmental movement, and this just drives my friends at Coal River Mountain Watch, you know, batty. So-called environmentalists are desperately opposing it. The Greenbrier Resort, owned by the C&O Railroad, is opposing it. And, among other things, they claim viewscape pollution.
You know, it is interesting. I mean, this is, of course, a bigger, broader conversation about what are our alternatives and their trade-offs. But certainly the windmill thing, you know, divides people in unexpected ways. I mean, big issue up off, isn't it Martha's Vineyard or Cape Cod?
Yeah. Hyannisport.
You know, they want to put a lot of these things out there offshore, and actually the Kennedys, among others, were opposed to it, and I think Viewscape was certainly the issue.
And so it's but of course, you know, here the AstroTurf environmental groups are well funded again by CNO, who hauls all of Don Blankenship's coal.
Sure.
And we, you know, we come back to Darth Vader, because Darth Vader does run the Death Star now, doesn't he? Now, as you,
yeah, although he sure was thrown off his game last week.
He was indeed, and I guess let me just ask you, because you do have the perspective of having immersed yourself in this issue so thoroughly, with and we've talked about this, so it's not inside baseball. Folks know where we're going. With the upheaval in the court system, do you see, based on your interviews and time spent and your research with folks like Joe Lovett, do you sense a turning tide?
Well, I'll say yes. I mean, it's, you know, cautious optimism, you know, mitigated first by the fact that there are so many existing permits for mountaintop mining that are being worked and will probably be worked for years. So, you know, even if every new permit was stopped tomorrow, you know, they'd be blasting in the mountains for years. So, you know, cautious optimism at best, but yes, it's a remarkable, dramatic turn of events that Hugh Caperton has found these photographs and proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that Don is, you know, unethically consorting with justices of the state Supreme Court that, you know, sitting in judgment of that $76 million settlement. But I think what's, you know, even more important, because that's a particular situation. You know, I mean, it's Don Blankenship, it's Massey Energy, but it's a particular story. One brave, small co-operator, Hugh Caperton, fighting the Goliath of Massey, and he may win yet. But, you know, what Joe does is bring these programmatic suits. He goes up against the Army Corps of Engineers because he knows that they're so important to this whole process. Stop me if your listeners all know this, but in essence, they are the ones who have to allow the coal companies to dump all that overburden, as they call it, from the mountaintop down into the valley stream, because the Army Corps of Engineers oversees the waters of the United States. So, you know, when Joe wins a lawsuit at the federal district level showing that the Army Corps of Engineers is violating the Clean Water Act every time it allows one of these variances, that is huge. I mean, that really does stop all new permitting by the Corps, and in effect throws a wrench in the works of all new permits. Now, of course, what always happens is that the government, on behalf of the Army Corps, then, you know, appeals it up to the what is the Fourth Circuit, which unfortunately is the most conservative court in the land. And what has happened in the three times that Joe has previously had his victories appealed is that the Fourth Circuit, you know, on some pretext, reverses it. What does give one grounds for cautious optimism now is that the Fourth Circuit's complexion is changing. Some of those justices, the most conservative ones, are retiring, dying. Bush no longer has political clout to get, you know, equally conservative justices put on the court. One of his most recent attempts, laughably, was a guy named Claude Allen, who was discovered shoplifting.
Yes.
Remember that one? You know?
Yes.
So, basically, Bush has given up on the Fourth Circuit, which means that that the next time Joe's latest victory is appealed, which will happen in the next year, you know, there's a chance that he'll get, they always, you know, there are 15 justices in all, and, you know, sort of supposedly random choice, you get three of them hearing your appeal. But again, only 10 justices. It's possible that he'll get a few that are moderate and that he'll win his appeal, or that he will, that is to say, the government will not reverse the ruling. And if that happens, that could really be big. So I have some optimism that that might happen. And so to see.
And well, let me also ask in these terms, please. You know, we've mentioned Don Blankenship, and he is the face of the evil face of this of this process. But if there were no Don Blankenship, there would, someone would, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, and someone would step into that void who also equally desperately wanted to continue blowing up mountains.
That's right. And, you know, by the way, I don't know if John Blankenship is evil.
That's okay. That's my job.
I think he's, you know what, I mean, I think he's kind of the ultimate Darwinian capitalist, unbothered, of course, by any sort of, you know, morality. I'm reminded a bit of a movie I saw last night, There Will Be Blood, you know, with Daniel Day-Lewis, the oil guy.
Right, yeah.
It's the early 20th century West. And the best thing about that movie is it just gives a sense of this absolutely rough and raw, you know, American spirit, sort of the dark side of the American spirit that just will not stop, you know, will extract those natural resources no matter what. And Don is kind of in that tradition. But now I've lost track of your question.
Well, no, it was the idea that someone would step in and be doing this, and we'd have a different picture besides Blankenship.
And actually, I mean, you know, let's not forget that other coal companies are doing it even now. You know, Peabody, Consol, Arch, they all do mountaintop mining.
Sure they do.
More modestly, and they don't run up the same number of violations, so they don't get whacked by the EPA as Matthew finally did last week for $20 million. You know, they're smarter about it, but they're still doing it.
And largely the impact is still the same. Moonscape is Moonscape is Moonscape.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There might be some nuances. Maybe Peabody does it slightly more delicately.
Well, as far as, you know, we talked about the Fourth Circuit. Beyond that, is there any hope, or do you see any hope of a legislative solution via a more toothy, emboldened Clean Water Act?
It's funny, the Clean Water Act doesn't need to be given new teeth. I mean, the fact is it has the teeth. I mean, we were so much more progressive 30, 40 years ago when that law was written. You know, Ed Muskie and others, and then finally even Nixon, I believe, is the one who signed it into law. It was remarkable how vigorous that law was and is. The problem is that we have an administration that does everything it can to deflect that law, you know, including just quietly changing the definitions of key words and aspects of the law so that they're turned on their head.
Yeah, those are clarifications. We've been clarified about half to death.
Streamlining. Just a little bit of streamlining. Nothing to worry about.
Well, let me ask you then. You traveled through the so-called coal fields. You've ridden Route 3 from Racine to Beckley. The excuse that's constantly given with all of this is coal's good for the economy. There was no economy that you observed, was there?
Well, very little. I mean, this is the thing. You know, the coal industry always says coal's good for the economy, and if you, you know, do anything like win any lawsuits that shut us down, all it means is that good West Virginians will lose their jobs. Well, you know, first of all, historically, coal always leaves poverty in its wake. You know, I mean, if there's a boom, they bring in lots of workers from out of state, earlier in the century, out of the country. And then when it's a bust, when the cycle goes down, all those people are out of work and they have no recourse. And, you know, meantime, whole communities are left destitute. I mean, I was shocked the first drove through Whiteville, you know, and saw this is a town that looks like it's been bombed.
Everything but tumbleweeds.
And the coal industry is telling us still that they're the great source of wealth in the country. They talk about the severance taxes and all that while doing everything they can to minimize or eliminate them. So, you know, I don't put much stock in the coal industry's talk of bringing wealth to the state. The only thing that one has to concede is that for those who actually work for the coal companies, Right now, you know, they can make $50,000 or more dollars with a high school education, maybe even without a high school education. And that's real. I mean, that's very significant in the Call River Valley. Of course, they have to, you know, agree to be non-union 99% of the time.
Sure.
But, you know, there is that effect. But overall, in the whole region, no. It just brings poverty and destruction.
Were you made aware of what has happened to the folks who do live there, whether it's coal dust or whether it's wells that have been blown up and poisoned or the flooding that comes with this problem from the clear cutting?
Well, I certainly heard all of that anecdotally. You know, I would go up in the hollows and talk to families whose children were sick an awful lot. Respiratory problems that, you know, the trouble with health problems is that it's very hard to make any kind of clear connection to what's going on. Even if right over the next ridge they're blasting away and the coal dust is, you know, billowing over the ridge, settling over the houses, it's still very hard to say from a scientific legal or legal point of view, you know, that coal dust made that child sick. But I certainly heard many stories of sickened children. I heard many stories of black water spills. I had some very dramatic conversations with the so-called dustbusters of Sylvester, the two wonderfully
Mary and Pauline
women who challenged Massey and brought the suit to court that they won for all the coal dust spread over their town by a Massey prep plant. You know, yeah, I saw plenty of evidence of pollution of water and air and also, you know, destruction of culture. I mean, I think too often it's forgotten that it's not even just the mountaintops, you know. It's the people and their communities, their culture. It's all under siege.
So what then, and I don't get, this is not a postscript or an epilogue or anything, whither southern West Virginia?
Well, I don't know. There's a fascinating transcript of a speech that some coal industry executive gave not too long ago where he proposed to a sympathetic audience that the answer was simply to depopulate the Coal River Valley, and that would solve the problem. And by God, it would, wouldn't it? I mean, if there were no people there, then no one would be threatened by coal mining, then the coal companies could just blast away.
It's sort of a really twisted Darwinian approach. You said Darwinian capitalism a little bit ago. It's the same. You know, if you take the smallpox blankets and you give it to the Indian tribes, then you don't have any Indians anymore.
That's right.
End of Indian problem.
So, you know, what will actually happen? I mean, I don't think the coal companies will succeed in depopulating the whole valley or the coal fields, but they'll make it harder and harder for them, and there will be fewer and fewer jobs. You know, it's important to point out that the number of jobs in the industry has diminished dramatically over the last decade. There used to be 150,000 West Virginians working in the coal industry. Now there's 15,000 with all the more coal being produced than before because everything's so mechanized. But even of that 15,000, only 3,500 work in mountaintop mining, last I heard. And, you know, that number diminishes as things get more efficient. So, you know, what will happen is just more and more people will feel obligated to leave the area, go find factory jobs out of state, and, you know, hope to come back and retire in the state. But, you know, hope that there's still some mountains to look at when they do.
So, you know, economic development is, you know, one of the things that when a lot of us get together, we talk about, you know, in terms of problems here in West Virginia, the word mono economy keeps popping up.
Yeah.
You know, if all you've got is coal, all your problems will tend to be solved by coal. If that makes any sense.
That's right. Yeah, your problems are created by coal, and I suppose in a sense you'd say they're solved by coal. I mean, it, you know, I sort of get back to the argument for mountaintop mining. I mean, it's sort of perverse, but you know, it's true that it is efficient, and indeed that coal is the only fierce industry down there. And yes, it would be nice to think that environmental tourism could come along in some incremental way to provide an alternative, but it is hard. I mean, that's why this is such an intractable, difficult situation. But at the end of the day, you know, no matter what there is in the economic balance, no matter how hard it would be to transform the economy, to retrain workers, to change the whole state's dependence on coal, is one thing on the other side of the balance, and that's the mountain. It's the state itself.
Yeah, that they themselves are worth the saving.
No.
That not everything has a dollar sign attached to it.
That's right. Exactly. And, Bob, you know, before we ring off, I want to say that for your listeners, assuming they are a sympathetic audience.
Oh, gosh, yes. If I didn't make that clear.
And I invite them all to come on Thursday, February 7th to Taylor Books in Charleston, you know, the wonderful independent bookstore.
Oh, I love it. It's my favorite.
Well, at 6 p.m. on that Thursday, February 7th, there's going to be a book event for Coal River. I'm going to talk a little bit about the book, but other people are going to talk too. Some of the people you know well. I hope both Joe Lovett and Judy Bonds will get up and say a few things. I'd really like it not just to be, you know, a book reading, you know, sort of boring tradition, but rather to have it be a kind of celebration of what everyone is doing to try to fight this. And, you know, so much of the time we have bad news or frustrating news, but I hope that on February 7th everyone could come and raise a glass and have a little fun.
Oh, I hope so, too. I'd love to be there. Unfortunately, I'll be here behind the microphone. But,
please, there in spirit, Bob.
Please know that I will be there in spirit, Michael. And again, best of luck as you go about promoting the book. The other side of that is this, you know, this program reaches around the globe. And as a consequence of that, please let me know anywhere that you're going to be doing anything promotional like that. And we'll certainly get that information out here. Because first and foremost, you've done a magnificent, magnificent service in terms of making this known outside the state. And all along, my thesis has developed that if we are to have change and if we are to have an end to this, all this energy, all this work that's been put forward by all these wonderful people is going to have to be bolstered by people outside this state demanding an end to the process. Because, as you noted, we don't have a lot of political help inside the boundaries of West Virginia.
Well, thank you, Bob. I mean, I guess we can only hope that the next president, whether Republican or Democratic, as long as he's somewhat moderate, unlike the current one, will do what needs to be done to see the Clean Water Act enforced and see other laws enforced, which will, you know, start to wind this terrible practice down.
Devoutly to be wished, as the saying goes. Thank you again, Michael Schneerson. We do appreciate it, and I hope the book sells like hotcakes.
All right, thanks so much.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Author Michael Schneerson, Coal River, the name of the book, published by Ferris, Strauss, and Giroux. Get it. Get a copy for somebody who doesn't know about it. Get a copy and give it to your local library. Because what gets said about this outside West Virginia is so, so very important. Because it makes possible what happens inside this state. You know, I've been talking with John Fox, he being our chief engineer, about figuring out some way to capture the sounds of the explosions that now go off around our home here. And we haven't quite completely sorted it out, but we're getting close, and we will get it sorted out. I want you to hear this stuff. And what Michael said about, you know, just sort of trying to journalistically tell a nice little environmental book and you're preaching to the choir, we've got to get beyond that. We absolutely have to get beyond that. And just a programming note before I go to the phones, I won't be on the air not next week, but let's see, what is it? February 4th, 5th, and 6th, I will not be on the air. I'm taking my first road trip on behalf of Coal River Mountain Watch, and I am so proud that they have entrusted me with the message. I'm going to be going to Williamstown, Massachusetts, to Williams College, to talk a little bit about it there. And I hope as time goes on, because people from Coal River Mountain Watch are positively bone exhausted. And they get so little rest. And so I hope that I can do justice to the effort. I sincerely do. And so that's February 4th, 5th, and 6th. The event is on the 5th, traveling on the 4th and the 6th. Let's do go to the phones and see what's going on here. Hi, who have I got?
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Hey, Preston.
I was listening with great interest to your interview there, and I actually went to the Coal River site on Amazon to check it out, to read about it, and it's selling quite well. It's 1,300 on Amazon, and, you know, and they've got hundreds of thousands of books.
Right.
And it's getting very good reviews.
Well, I did go and I read some of the reviews on Amazon, Preston, and I was pleased with what I saw. I hope I didn't make Michael uncomfortable just by trying to ask questions about, or you know, sort of hard questions or whatever. But
well,
he's done a tremendous service.
Well, and there were good hard questions. I mean, what you were asking about. Is this as black and white as it seems, or, you know, what's their argument? And, you know, that was a very good question. And, because we need to know what they are saying. How are they rationalizing this? And I, you know, what they're saying about, well, you got to have these jobs and so forth and got to be efficient and we've got to be in competition with what the Chinese are doing or whatever. It's, when you look into it, it's really gibberish. And
well, what he said, you know, Darwinistic capitalism or Darwinistic economics, it is true. I mean, now if we all know that if you and I sit here and we talk so much about the uncalculated cost of coal, yeah. That we don't calculate sickness in, we don't calculate the loss, yeah, of peoples who are now qualify as indigenous, who've been on the same land for 300 and 400 years nearly.
Yep.
And longer when you consider the number of people in southern West Virginia who carry Native American blood. When we don't calculate that, so, you know, as long as they don't have to, then it just looks cheap. And it's especially cheap because they constantly moan about having to reclaim the filth that they create.
Yep.
So as a consequence of that, as long as you don't have to apply any sort of reasonable or meaningful metrics to the process, well, yeah, it's cheap. But the fact of the matter is, I've seen some numbers bandied about by some of the folks at Coal River, and I think it turned out the difference, if all of our coal was deep mined versus mountaintop removed, might be $120 difference on the annual power bill.
Yep. And as he was saying, I mean, there could be more jobs and better jobs. There could be entirely different sorts of jobs and in tourism and what he was bringing up about, you know, possibly commercial hunting. And I'm sure some people would have problems with that, but still a much better option than just seeing the place decimated as that photo on the cover so powerfully illustrates. I mean, you know, even if people don't get to read the book, just seeing that image on the cover of it is a very powerful message. And people like Diane Rehm, he mentioned her not really knowing about the issue at all. And so it's good that this message is getting further out there. And, you know, I thought your interview was really, really good. And it's good to hear that you're traveling to speak further on this issue. I heard you in the movie, actually, Rise Up West Virginia. That was great. I did get to see that this week. And another great tool for raising awareness. I thought BJ did a wonderful job with that film and just made the issue a lot more intimate to me than it had been. So I plan on getting an additional copy of it, actually. And I hope I don't know if BJ has an email, or I'm sure I could find one, but I hope she makes it available on Amazon.
I'm sure she'd love to hear you say that. If you go to patchworkfilms.com, there's a contact button there.
Okay.
But, you know, something you mentioned, the power, the immediate power of that cover photograph is, it's reminiscent of what he said about, you know, when he first came in, you know, you drive through there's no fields, and all you see are these towering mountains and these narrow valleys, and once in a while you'll drive by a coal prep plant, well, you know, big deal, so what? But it's when you get in the plane, and it's when you fly over, and you see these things that look like syphilitic scabs on the mountains themselves, that you begin to realize what's going on. Because first and foremost, the first and foremost tool in the PR arsenal of the mountaintop removal industry is to not have you see it.
Yeah. The PR arsenal, that's a good way of putting it. I remember during a lot of periods of deforestation, they have some logging companies leave trees along the highways so that people get
exactly
the impression that they're driving through a forested area and don't see the rape of the land as clearly. But yeah, the PR arsenal is just, it's amazing. It encourages this kind of group hallucination, really. And slowly but surely, though, I do think people are starting to break out of it.
And that's what makes it so important for what people like Michael are doing, because it's having someone who's, oh God, I don't want to be offensive, okay? That's not my purpose, and I feel like I've already put my foot in my mouth, and I feel kind of icky already, because I wouldn't have made him uncomfortable for the life of me, but I'm afraid somehow or another I confused issues, and I don't like that. But on the one hand, it's very valuable for people who live here to go out and tell people what's going on. There is an immediacy to that as well.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, when people who are not from here, who don't, as we like to say, have a dog in the hunt, say, holy cats, I've been there, this, and, you know, and tell some group of well-heeled upper-middle-class types in Connecticut, you wouldn't let it happen here, and confront them, Preston, and say, why are you willing to let it happen there?
Yeah.
Because your lights are on because of what is going on in West Virginia.
Yeah. I actually had the opportunity to bring up this issue with some people in another part of the country. In Alaska, I found a progressive radio station that streams there. And they were talking about their issues with the oil industry and the spill and the Valdez and the regular spills that take place that we don't hear anything about. Prudhoe Bay, I mean, there's something getting dumped in there on a regular basis. Same will happen if they open up ANWR.
Sure. And to realize that Exxon went back to court not 6 months ago and pled, and we'll have a decision on that, and we'll be screaming here, I'm sure, and pled to the Supreme Court that it would be unduly harsh for them to actually have to, all these years after the Exxon Valdez, all these years after that, that it would be unduly harsh for them to finally have to pay up.
Right. Here in Colorado, it's a different sort of assault, but, I mean, they're planning on building tens of thousands of more drills into this, you know, various areas, public and private land, but this one area in particular called the Rhone Plateau. And our governor, Bill Ritter, I think the National Resources Defense Council or people like that took him on a trip through the Rhone Plateau, and he was quoted in the paper as saying he went there and he saw this wilderness and he had something akin to a religious experience or a spiritual experience. Instantly, he was mocked for that, you know, by...
Oh, I'm sure. And,
you know, the PR arsenal was firing away for sure. And he got all kinds of grief and pressure to kind of change his thinking on that. And like that politician you were talking about who said mountaintop removal should be abolished and then just got pounded. So,
well, no, that was Jay Rockefeller.
Oh, okay, Jay Rockefeller.
The first time he ran for governor, and he was, you know, he was pounded for it.
Okay.
And the next time he never came, never was heard a discouraging word about strip mining or mountaintop removal, and that was the beginning of his political career, and it continues to this day.
Okay.
And we can't get any help from him. We can't get it from Byrd. We can't get it from Ray Hall. We can't get it from Capitol, and we can't get it from Mollahan.
Mm-hmm.
Our governor is in debt to the industry. Our governor showed up at a party last night for the dirty Supreme Court justice, a fundraiser, mind you, for the dirty Supreme Court justice who got caught cavorting on the French Riviera with Don Blankenship, and the governor shows up and glad hands and is the guest of honor.
Mm.
Okay,
yeah.
I mean, does that give you? I'm not trying to beat you over the head, Preston.
No,
does that give you an idea of what we're dealing with?
Yeah, it's a real sickness.
The president of the Senate was at... Yeah, the president of the West Virginia Senate was at that fundraiser. The speaker of the West Virginia House was at that fundraiser. And it was held by one of the ranking Democrats in the West Virginia Senate.
You know, a lot of what goes on, people not only get pressured, the population or particular politicians or whoever, you know, we hear a lot about how we're controlled through fear. And there is that goes on, job threats, intimidation, whatever. But on the other side, sometimes we get manipulated through desires, and they start giving cash and help people live this high life. And there are, you know, ladies of the evening who will show up at your door, you know, like they did for Bush's brother in, what was it, Thailand or someplace?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
People get seduced by these things.
Well, they gave me the hooker. I couldn't send her away. That would have been rude.
And then once you do it, if that does happen, if you have succumbed to that stuff, then they can hold that against you. So if you have a change of heart, they'll expose you for having, you know, sexual scandal exposure. If you start finding your conscience again, I'm sure that kind of manipulation happens. I don't know, but I guess I'm kind of speculating, but it wouldn't surprise me. So I don't know. I'm just recognizing more the ways in which some of our politicians are being kind of held over a barrel. And, you know, it's going to take a larger movement to overcome those forces. You know, whether it's Jay Rockefeller or, you know, I saw Obama recently. I learned about him. He used to be very active in the Muslim and Palestinian and Arab Muslim community in Illinois. There's a photo of him actually at a fundraiser for Palestinian refugees sitting next to Edward Said. Now, when that comes out, they're just going to they're going to tear him apart, the right wing, over that. But the thing is...
Well, they may not. Frankly, Senator Clinton may tear him apart for it first.
True. True. The thing is, lately, he's been much more not sympathetic to Arab issues and more, you know, promoter of America's military base called Israel and whatever they do for their... It's always about Israel's security. The words Palestinian security are not in our lexicon. It's so racist. It's mind-boggling.
Oh, I know. And the same thing applies, and it's what scares the life out of me. You know, one of the things Michael pointed out was that, you know, with a change in administration, with a change in the Congress, maybe we can see a renewed sort of revivification, if you will, of the Clean Water Act, and sweep away some of these clarifications and streamlining and so streamline permitting processes and so forth. But on the occasions when she and he have each been asked about it, both Senators Clinton and Obama have said in no uncertain terms that they are a firm believer in clean coal technology as a vital tool in this nation's battle for energy independence.
Right. Well, wasn't it disturbing to see that one of the Democrats' debates, one of the early debates, was sponsored by the so-called clean coal industry? Did you catch that?
No.
Yeah, like their first or second debate.
Oh, yeah, I did, yeah. Yeah.
Talked to you by your friends at Clean Coal and, you know, their messaging throughout the talk. So, again...
And John Edwards is the only one who's come out four square against it, so that, you know, that gives me a pretty easy choice come May if he's still in the race. I really get a Hobson's choice, though, if it's just down to those two.
Yeah, but who knows, again, if in addition to a change in presidency and change in the Congress, you know, more of a change in the population and it becoming more active, I think,
yeah,
and organizing better, I think, and who knows, maybe it could pressure them.
Well, if you knew that wasting electricity caused people's lives to individual lives and groups of people's lives to be ruined in a specific part of the country, and that those people were considered to be your fellow Americans, speaking sort of generally, and not you being the conscious person you are, Preston, but generally speaking, wouldn't you have a harder time wasting it?
Yeah. And again, those rationales come in that, oh, well, we have to do this because we have to have energy. And what they're keeping from us, in addition to the destruction being caused in the sickness, are the viable options that are already in place in many areas and can be easily expanded, where we don't have to tear the earth up to have energy and to have a pleasant lifestyle. In fact, to his credit, Bill Clinton, I wanted to read that blurb he actually gave to that book that I enjoyed so much called Natural Capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a couple sentences.
Sure, go ahead.
It said, President Bill Clinton's blurb on the back of the book says, "Natural capitalism basically proves beyond any argument that there are presently available technologies and those just on the horizon which will permit us to get richer by cleaning, not by spoiling the environment." You know, the coal industry PR people see quotes like that, and that's when they really want to, you know, that's when they go after Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
With all his faults, you know, the NAFTA stuff and whatever, a whole range of things. He did have a moment like that.
Yeah. So, well, sometimes I think one of the things that happens with Bill Clinton is that he's either a big picture guy or a sort of micromanagement guy.
Uh-huh.
And that he has a hard time seeing what happens when the two merge on the middle ground. If that makes any sense.
Sure.
You know, globalization is good. Okay, I'm with you. Globalization is good, but globalization is only good if everybody's on a level playing field. If globalization is nothing but a euphemism for creating another mercantilist 17th century mercantilist triangle, then globalization is not good.
That's right. What kind of globalization are we talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Preston, I need to roll on. I've got a couple of blinkies here, but have a great weekend, and thank you for all your observations, and let BJ know how much you enjoyed the movie, please.
I will. I'll drop her a line for sure.
All right, great.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. And on the line with us now, all the way from Sydney, like that's any big deal, we work miracles here. Our own head-banging, ranting, tree-hugging hippie and chief engineer, John Fox, you're on for topic A, but John, I imagine you can't go to topic A without first addressing topic B, namely, you know, the conversation we just had.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading the book, which I think I'm going to order that off of Amazon right quick, because I read the excerpt when you sent it to me last week, and I like what I saw. And, you know, this is all part of what I was even talking about the last couple of nights on my show, that I actually think 2008 we're going to have, you know, some movement on this issue, because there are forces at work to bring it to the wider national audience, and as you've said before, this is the only way that we're going to be able to get real movement on this issue. And when the rest of the nation starts to come to the understanding that, you know, one of the previously most pristine, beautiful places in the United States is just being, you know, gutted for profit, and at what cost? I'm hoping that we're going to see some movement. You know, we've seen permits for new coal-fired power plants being turned back because the myth of clean coal is becoming more apparent that it is a myth, and it's saying, you know, well, you know, if it's not a reality yet, you can't have the permit. So once it's a reality, then you might be able to get the permit. So I think that this is just one piece of the puzzle in making some real strides in this. And the people are catching up with the science. I really do believe that. When I see things like in Kansas that they're, you know, blocking permits for new plants.
Yes, that was the Sunflower Energy Company, wasn't it?
Yeah, that one just, you know, it's a sunflower. Oh, you know, I mean, how Orwellian an opposite world can you get?
I know. I expect one of these days to drive down the road and find it, and find a sign by a gate that says Kitties and Puppies Company.
The Fuzzy and Cuddly Coal Company.
Yeah.
But on the subject that my input was truly requested on, I watched that Romney clip a few times.
Okay.
And I have a few theories. First, the comical one. One of his handlers was actually, you know, inside his podium prompting him. But I don't think that that's the case. Now there's a post at Raw Story that the network has come out saying that there were audio problems with Romney's mic. So someone else chimed in. That doesn't add up.
Yeah, why would any other candidate whisper, raise taxes? Because it's obviously a whisper. I mean, it's breathy. It's not, I mean, you know, if somebody else chimed in, it was Marilyn Monroe.
Now, the other claim was, it was some sort of bleed from Russert's prompter trying to get him to finish the question, but it was way too on top of things for it to have possibly been that kind of a cue. Now, I have a couple of theories, and none of these can I prove. However, they're theories based on what I heard. First, the whisper was so clear. It was definitely someone in close proximity to a condenser microphone. Now,
okay, let's be geeky for a minute, John. Why does it have to be a condenser and not a dynamic?
Dynamic microphones are basically a little speaker working in reverse, and they work on an actual physical process where it's actually pushing the diaphragm to create a charge. Now, a condenser microphone does not require any movement. It's actually a charged capsule, and it picks up the differences in pressure between two plates. So they're far more sensitive, and it was because of the audio quality of the whisper and the clear sibilance involved that and the type of microphones that they use on those podiums would probably are most definitely a condenser type. They always are. I have never ever come across a dynamic style podium microphone. They're always condensers, or else you would never be able to at that distance be able to get the gain to utilize them. So my theories are, here's the most evil one. If the media, say, you know, this is an NBC thing or MSNBC thing, if they are actually kind of stage managing this thing to the hilt, and if candidates have in-ear monitoring systems, which is, you know, you see videos with, say, Radiohead or anybody else, and you see where they haven't actually tucked the wires in, those molded earplugs that go into their ears, those are their monitoring systems. They're wireless, and you create a mix off of the main audio system in which for them to hear what they need to hear. So just like just like the pack that was, you know, the bad stitching on Bush's back a few years back, looked exactly like the size that would be the receiver pack for Shure or a Sennheiser in-ear monitor system. They don't cost much money, and they're really very good. Now, what I do not think that this was anything about radio crosstalk. My first impression is if NBC is actually providing the infrastructure for these people to be queued, that would mean that the handlers, microphones, and everything would be going through the main console and split. Now, they would normally then not have any of those signals actually open to the mix going to broadcast. However, they can make individual mixes that go to these particular transmitters for the in-ear monitor systems.
Yeah, discrete and unique.
Right. So just you know, when I go and do a gig with some, you know, person singing to track and they're using in-ears, and say the drummer gets a click track, I have the click track coming into my board, but that's not going to the mix. It's only going to the drummer's headphones for him to keep time. So it's very easy to do this kind of thing. So somewhere, if the network is involved in setting up this infrastructure so that they can stage these things, the way that I actually, you know, the way this whole thing's been stage managed since moment one has been very disturbing. Either someone opened up a channel that they weren't supposed to by accident, or, you know, I have the impression of a momentary either operator error, or maybe a sound guy with a conscience who decided to let something loose. The less evil version of it would be that it was either one of the other candidates whispering under their breath. Because if it was a whisper at the distance from those microphones, that would have been the type of audio quality you would have gotten.
Mm-hmm.
It was so clean. It was definitely something within their system. And MSNBC's excuses do not cover what this was. When they say Romney had microphone trouble, if Romney had been having microphone trouble, we would have not heard Romney for a moment, or we would have heard a slight dip in the underlying atmospheric noise level because his channel went down. I imagine that they have, while they're running that thing, they have all those podium mics sitting at least open.
Well, we know that they do from past experience, John. Because if you recall the conversation between Senator Edwards and Senator Clinton early in the pageant process, when, you know, one leaned over to the other and didn't realize the mic was open, and said, you know, we really need to figure out a way to narrow this field so we can have better conversations. Remember that?
Yep.
Mic was open, and of course, and of course, maybe that's to a certain extent that part is a novice's mistake. Because one of the things you'll figure out when you have microphones in your home or in your home studio is that, or God knows if you're learning the radio business in a radio station that's monitored by the FCC, the first rule of thumb is every microphone is always a hot microphone.
Yeah, and any audio operator doing something like that live to broadcast may pull back those that aren't the focus, but you're never going to shut them down completely in case one of them jumps in. You would be buying drinks for the crew if you missed a crucial line. It's disturbing to listen to. Now, from the video, that particular video, I can't actually see if he has an earpiece. Now, I haven't gone and watched any of the rest of the footage to see if he ever turns from that slightly looking to the right side that obscures the right ear. So I have no way to verify that. I guarantee that there's probably no rear shots of the candidates in the broadcast. It was so clean. Like I said, the two things that come to mind are one of the other candidates. I don't think it was Russert. It doesn't sound like it would be him.
Well, there's no motive for Russert to whisper.
Right. Exactly. You know, if it was him finishing the question, it would have come out in the same delivery that he did everything else. And this is my tinfoil hat going on, I would not be surprised if they had in the rig, in the actual broadcast rig, all of the prompting stuff. And I don't doubt for a second that these candidates, especially on the right side, get prompted by their handlers.
Well, so, we know because, I mean, they do intensive pageant preparation. In turn, you know, they have people, they have surrogates in there playing each and every candidate. They've got surrogates playing the moderator, all the questioners, and they rehearse these things, so they absolutely do.
Yeah, the thing that makes me think even more that the network would be involved is purely the technical aspect. If you come into a remote broadcast that is using a whole bunch of radio gear, now the stage management people would be on radio communication transceivers with headphones and microphones to call cues, to do things. You would have I would imagine, I didn't look close enough, but even though they're at podiums, I guarantee that every single one of those candidates also had a wireless lapel system as a backup for the podium. And the other thing that could be is that the lapels could be used for the broadcast, and the podiums being used for the in-house PA system. So that would all have to be coordinated, because if you came walking in, if I was the handler for Romney and I had my own little rig of, you know, a Shure in-ear system and my own little mixer and microphone so that I could prompt him, I would have to coordinate for my own security with the audio people that we weren't using the same frequency as something else being used in the system. There is a program that you can download from the Shure site called ClearScan. And you actually, straight out of the audio guy's laptop, plugs into a series of cables that go into all of the transmitters and receivers. And it does a complete scan of all radio activity within the reception area to look for clashes and bad frequencies, and it will reprogram the receivers and transmitters accordingly. So, I mean, this is something in this modern day of audio. So much stuff is done wireless that you have to be very, very careful. And you can have two different systems from two different outfits, and they could be just close enough together. Most systems are able to run on multiple frequencies. The average Shure system has they're grouped into actual frequency groups and then channels, and so there's about I think 20 groups and 20 channels per group.
Well, let me ask you one other possibility, and this may fall into one of the hypotheticals you already set up, and I just didn't understand it correctly. You know, for instance, When we're doing, you know, when you're doing your show and I'm producing here, or anybody else, any of the other remote hosts and I'm producing, we have production conversation going back and forth, you know, visually.
Yeah.
But it's also possible, to, you know, and it's not that complicated. And someday we'll have time to work it out. where we can do it auditorily.
Absolutely.
And out in the truck, whether it's Monday night football or the Thursday night political pageant, producers, line producers, directors, cameramen are all mic'd, and they talk.
Yeah.
Is it possible that somewhere along the way the internal production line audio just got one guy, oh, taxes.
Well, you see that yeah. Now, the thing being that the wireless headset and microphone things that the technicians would be on are pretty secure. And they run very much outside of any of the actual broadcast mic systems. So any kind of accidental radio crosstalk is pretty much out of the question. Now, you go into almost any broadcast studio, and the audio guy will not only have his regular kind of comms, but he'll have a microphone in his desk that he can then click on and kind of send out any of the pathways that he's got by choice. So he can either send it, through everything, say, that thing going, 10 seconds to broadcast type
right.
thing. Or
camera
he
three
can actually
zoom
yeah,
in.
Well, that's a little bit separate, and that would not usually be going. That would usually end up being nowhere near the audio console.
Yeah, true. Well, John, I'm getting a quick request here, just from the chat room, just to sort of, because we only ran it once when I was talking with Carolyn Kay, just to run it again. Let me take just a couple of seconds and do that so people can familiarize themselves.
Governor Romney, you are a big fan of Ronald Reagan. Will you do for Social Security what Ronald Reagan did in 1983?
I'm not going to raise taxes. What I'm going to do...
Well, Ronald Reagan...
Now, apart from monkeying with the audio a little bit, I didn't change the response time or anything like that. What I did do was to elevate that.
You selected that bit of audio and just increased the volume. That's all you've done.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm in the process of restoring it to what it was. Okay, just for the sake of being natural. This is how it started.
Governor Romney, you are a big fan of Ronald Reagan. Will you do for Social Security what Ronald Reagan did in 1983?
I'm not going to raise taxes.
I have no doubt that it's a prompt. Where it came from and why it came through, I don't know. Now, if they're actually using, and it actually does sound there. That was the unprocessed one?
Yeah.
Or is that actually, okay, is that off the video clip from Crooks and Liars?
Yes,
they
it is.
Did, okay, they have done some gameplay with it as well. However, it sounds like a push-switch microphone, so that it's muted unless they need to talk. So, because you can hear it kind of and come up.
And
I don't think that...
And Romney is, whether he is or isn't actually, Romney's the so-called victim here because he's the one that everybody can look at and go, that's the kind of idiot that would have to be prompted. Although it could have been any of the other idiots... own prompter saying raise taxes, in case Romney flubbed the answer, and you could jump in and say, oh, he will do what Ronald Reagan did. Is Governor Romney saying that he's gonna raise taxes? But what I think is important here in this consideration, because frankly, I wouldn't care if the earth opened up all the way to hell and swallowed every Republican candidate for president, 5 minutes ago. What is important here is to note that, once again, the little bastards cannot compete without cheating.
Absolutely. 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 Gone is the day where political candidates go into public forums where they can be challenged and put on the spot. It has become so stage managed that it's a joke.
It's kabuki theater.
The entire thing's a joke. I mean, the where I saw it coming to a whole new level still was one of the early Democratic pageants when we had, you know, 11 guys, up, you know, 11 people up there or whatever. And the way that they would arrange the podiums and then shoot the thing. And they were working very hard, very early on, to, you know, put Gravel and Kucinich on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And they allowed, and it started out, they put the focus on Richardson, Edwards, Obama, and Clinton. And one by one, as they're able to remove the outside people, they continue to shrink the focus.
Yeah, it's like an Agatha Christie novel or something where, you know, one by one, they just get knocked off.
Yeah, and then there was one.
Yeah.
And so this whole thing has been so unbelievably stage managed. And the Republicans, you know, we got to remember that it was Ronald Reagan that changed American immigration law to allow Rupert Murdoch to become a U.S. citizen so he could even own U.S. media.
Yeah, so many forget.
Okay, so, you know, it was illegal until Reagan, but then it was a thing of saying, you know, the so-called liberal media that did things like, you know, investigate Watergate and showed the dark side of the Vietnam War, like the secret bombings in Cambodia. Anything that they could do to manipulate the image, they would do. And anyone that turns around and says, "I did the conspiracy nut," no, this is direct action. This was changing actual federal immigration law to get around something that was intended to protect the American people,
as well as the integrity of our constitutionally enabled media.
And now we have this thing that's developed. You know, I distinctly remember back, back in, say, you know, Reagan's reelection, and they do the debates. The debates were hosted by, you know, the Sisters of the Republic, not Friends of Coal.
Yeah.
Right?
When it comes down to a head-to-head, the League of Women Voters will be allowed one debate.
Okay, so it was the League of Women Voters. They were the ones that really ran it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And the whole idea was that it was, you know, this was a, you know, a pretty much nonpartisan group that would select the venue, select the moderator or moderators, and you had a fairly good feeling about what you were watching.
Well, the real turning point, the first televised debate was Richard Nixon and John Kennedy, and that slaughtered Nixon because he looked like a guy being led to his execution who was just sweating his brains out. He was like an acid trip. His face melted on the TV screen. But the next seminal moment in debate history comes in 1988 when 1988 when Bernie Shaw when CNN gets to have a hand in it. And Bernie Shaw asks Michael Dukakis the immortal question about, well, you don't like the death penalty, but what if Willie Horton came and raped your wife and then killed her? You know, because it had absolutely nothing to do with public policy. It had absolutely nothing to do with his ability to be president. It was purely a gotcha question. It was nothing but a cheap attempt to create a tawdry political spectacle. So
absolutely, and that's and
that's after that,
all we have left.
Yeah, and after that, the debates have been caca. You know, they they just have been. Hey, John, I've got a bunch of Blinkens here, but thank you for taking part of your weekend to come in and tech out what I thought was a fascinating little story. You know, I personally think that if you've got a few minutes to call your own over the weekend, you ought to turn this into a rather detailed and technical explanation like what you've done here, and put it out on the internet as an audio expert explains Romney Gate.
There's a thought for you. Like I said, I have no definitive answer, but I have a couple of theories, but I have no doubt that there's someone prompting.
Well, and that's the point. That's the point, because if you go and read the blog post, you know, was it Russert? You know, some of this stuff just needs to be thrown out the window as, no, this was not Tim Russert.
Yeah.
Russert did not raise taxes under his breath.
Yeah, there are two cover stories that have come out are complete just crap.
Yeah, to the point that MSNBC has been forced to yank things from the website. Exactly. John,
yeah.
A very good weekend to you, my brother.
You too, my friend. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. And enjoy Invasion Day.
Yeah. Wait till Monday's show. It'll be a kicker.
All right. Later.
Later.
John Fox, chief engineer of the Head On Radio Network, taking time out of his weekend to make sense of the senseless. Because it involves Republican presidential candidates. It's if it's Tuesday, this must be Peoria. If it's Republicans, it must be crazy. And once again, the party of Nixon. It's not the party of Lincoln. Kiss my butt. It's the party of Nixon. And once again, the party of Nixon, just like they did with their little 527 front group that they filed for a couple of days ago. They specialize in dirty tricks and division. And somebody has. I personally think somebody dirty tricked Romney one way or the other to show that Willard Romney was an idiot, or to make him look more like one. Not make him look like one, because he is one, but to make it more obvious. Yeah, buy that in a second. Onward and outward, telephone wise.
Hi there.
Hey, Susan, what's up?
First of all, I wanted to mention to everybody who heard the author of Coal River, if you want to buy the book, go down to the Head On Radio blog, the show post, and it's got an image of the book, and if you click on it, you can buy it through the Horn store and thereby make some money for the Horn.
Yes, indeed. And every little bit does help.
Yes. And secondly, I had an idea.
Okay.
When you were mentioning recordings of the blasting.
Yes.
Now I know they are either blasting or getting ready to blast very close to Minette's home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's make recordings of that, and let's put them up on the internet. And better yet,
sure,
make them downloadable. So we can send them to our Congress critters.
Yeah, exactly. And the question, what I'm working out with John is is not so much the why, but the how. Because I've got to have a microphone outside.
Yeah.
They are in fact expensive, sensitive pieces of electronics, and it's the dead of winter here. And you don't just want to.
You don't want to do it when it's going to ruin the mic.
No, you don't. You don't want your $400 microphone getting snowed on.
No.
Plus, I don't have a hoity-toity condenser mic either, and that's really kind of what you'd want for this. But I think we'll remedy it, because it's not like they're going to stop day after tomorrow.
Well, that's true, but not just where they're blasting near you, but also in the net, because I know they're blasting real close to our house.
Oh, I know. So it becomes a technical issue of how to get that equipment to Nanette.
Well, even if she has just a plain old tape recorder.
Yeah and no. Because plain old tape recorder won't necessarily cut the mustard. Because you want it to sound like what it sounds like.
Uh-huh.
and the the little tiny condensers that are embedded inside plain old tape recorders
aren't worth much.
Yeah, they don't get a lot
done.
You're
right there.
Yeah. Ever listen to the microphone on a webcam?
No.
Right.
Well, I was thinking if we can get as many different recordings as possible. If you call up your Congress critter and say, "Hey, I want to email you guys an audio file. What email address would I send it to?" They'll give you an email address.
Yeah.
As long as you let them know ahead of time.
True, true, very much so. So, you know, I think that's one way to make things much more immediate. There's visual, there's audio, there's visual, there's aural, and there's oral. And there's tactile, and there are ways of appealing to every one of those senses. There's a way of bringing all five senses into the comprehension of what the hell and damnation is created, and I don't use those as swear words. I use those as, you know, literal words, is created by this practice.
And I was on the phone screaming to my Congress critters today. I started with the chicken in every pot routine and went directly in from there into mountaintop removal, saying, you know, guys, if you want to make a real difference, here's how you do it.
And again, good, because it'll be, you know, just as the TVA was invented, the Tennessee Valley Authority was invented by a senator from Nebraska, so too we will eventually, ultimately, win the fight against mountaintop removal by some senator or some congressman from a place we know not which.
Yeah.
Who will stand up for us when our own elected representatives will not.
And that's one thing I've made it a point to mention every time I've talked about this to the Congress critters. These people have no representation. Byrd, the other Congress people from that state are bought and paid for.
Of course, you know, other Congress critters hate hearing that because a lot of them are bought and paid for, too. But, yeah, they're going to have to just darn well get used to it. Exactly.
Yeah, and suck it up and listen.
Precisely. Susan, have a great weekend.
I'm ending my rant.
All right.
You too.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Hi, who have I got?
Hey, Bob.
Hey, what's up?
Well, I was just listening to you and John. That was pretty good. I tell you what, the one that still always sticks out in my mind has to be the Howard Dean scream.
Well, and yeah, that's part of it too. And that's
because I heard it on C-SPAN, you know, when it was the whole thing, and you couldn't hardly hear him for that crowd. That's why he was yelling.
No,
like
but
that.
By the time the networks got done with it, it sounded like Tarzan yelling for Jane.
Well, it sounded like he was in the room by himself.
Yeah.
I mean, they totally zapped out the crowd noise. So that's what it made him sound like. He was screaming. Well, he was, but he was screaming in the room full of screaming people.
I know.
But oh Lordy, well I'm curious about last night. Have you had a chance to look at any of that over at Crooks and Liars and saw the? We can't call it a. I don't know what you want to call it.
It's a pageant.
Yeah, well, it wasn't even a pageant last night. That was a dog and pony show. I mean, that was the case of. You know, isn't it amazing how different?
Well, the sense I got
are when they have a Democratic group and they have a Republican group.
Yeah, the sense I got of it was that if it had gotten any more friendly, Barney the Dinosaur would have had to come out and sing "I love you, you love me."
Yeah. It was sort of like, you know, when I watched them do the Democratic one, it was like, boy, we're all just going to, you know, aim everybody at the front runner. Go and hit the front runner, hit him again. This one is like McCain almost became the invisible man for part of the thing.
Because in large part, they don't know who the front runner is. Because it's not, or most of America doesn't, Luke, because
no.
McCain's not the front runner.
Well, you know, I mean.
It's Romney. Romney's the one with the delegates right now.
Yeah.
And he's hiding low in the weeds.
Well, I say it's interesting now to hear him, though, because if you hear all the national shows, they're talking that McCain's the front runner. Which, you know, I mean, you're kind of sitting there going, what is this? Is this sort of, or are we playing the shell game? McCain's runner. No, here's Romney.
It's Romney on the inside. It's Romney. Oh, coming on the outside turn. It's McCain. Yeah.
But you wonder if it's, you know, I say, if it is sort of like a shell game, if they're trying to trying to make McCain the target, so when they're attacking McCain, Romney slips in, or it's the other way around. It's a little bit one way or the other.
But there were plenty of mentions of Hillary Clinton.
Well, that's what I mean. It's like, you know, Tim, where were you? Why weren't you up there saying, hey, guys, we're here talking about the Republicans?
I know.
You know, the same way you kept directing all the shots at Mrs. Clinton when you were in the Democratic debate. I mean, lordy be, it's just interesting just to see the way that they play. Like I say, played when they did, had Democrats and when they had Republicans. Oh, I tell you what, I tell you a good one today that if anybody wants to go read, is go over to Daily Howler. Bob Summersby was on fire tonight.
Oh, good.
He went, as he said, Tim Russert and his trophy wife, Brian Williams.
Oh, God, I love snark.
Yeah, it was pretty good. They were on that. And, you know, it's just one of those things when you sit here watching this stuff, you're just kind of like, huh? Yeah. And this thing with the thing in Congress, we're going to give you all back $300. Now, is this like 2001 when it's our $300 and we have to pay it back at tax time?
You're darn right, because there ain't no such thing as a free lunch.
Yeah. I mean, I always remember that. Was like, here's your $300, and in April you pay that right back to us. But we want you to have it for 6 months.
Yeah.
Like, huh?
Well, we want you to let Walmart have it for 6 months.
Yeah.
That's the fraud of this whole thing. Is that there's no economic stimulus in it, because there's very little in the way
American-made.
Yeah, there's very little America to stimulate.
Because that's the problem. They were talking about it yesterday. I heard somebody talk about it. Said the only problem with this is the only way it stimulates America is if you buy something American.
I think there's one tire company in America left that makes tires in America. What is it?
Yeah.
Cooper? Kelly? I can't remember which.
I think it's Cooper.
And you know, virtually no shoes. Little or no clothing. So you know,
like
God knows,
no,
you know what?
You
what was, yeah, what was the last American color TV? Curtis Mathis.
Oh God!
And they're, you know, see ya, goodbye. So
yeah,
you know,
we got one of those back in the back storeroom. We used to have it for a display. Yeah.
Well, you know, I was producing Guy James's remote show from the healthcare grassroots conference at the Mayflower Hotel in D.C. today, and he had one of these. He had a right winger come on.
Oh boy!
I forget what this freak's name was, but he's all over the television. You would have heard his name, recognized it immediately, and hated him twice as much.
Mm.
But he said, you know, we don't have a healthcare crisis in America because all those uninsured people. We need to walk into their homes and look at their $4,500 flat screen TVs.
Oh.
So, you know, apparently if you watch television, you know, in Rapiglia world, if you watch television, you don't have a right to go to the doctor.
Well, what was that thing a few months ago, or a month ago, you know, we had the story of the boy who, when they were doing the S-chip, and they were complaining, well, you have a house. How dare you have a house and expect the government to help pay for your medical?
What? You're getting S-chip and you don't live in a box?
Yeah. Like, the only way you're going to get this is, by golly, if you're living in a car, and even then, we may want you to sell the car.
I know. Hey, Luke, we've stacked it up here, but, brother, I tell you what, I thank you for the call, and we'll look for you on the next week.
All righty.
All right.
See you then.
And watch, is it still icy there?
Huh?
Still icy there?
No, it's, now they're saying by Monday it's supposed to be in the 50s.
Oh, get out the Bermuda shorts.
See
you, Luke.
Be the heat wave.
Bye now.
See ya.
You guys do this to me every time. You wait till the last minute, and then the phones light up. I love you guys. Hey, who I got?
Well, it's Kate, and we wait till the last minute because you talk too damn long.
Oh, well, excuse the hell out of me. I thought it was a talk show.
It's a conversation radio. You're right. I messed up. Congratulations on the speaking tour. That rocks.
Well, I don't know that one trip makes for a tour, and I am filled with dread and trepidation at the idea of getting on an airplane.
Oh.
Amtrak. Amtrak don't go there. Amtrak. Nope, train don't go there. And I would have had to have left 2 weeks ago if I was going to get there on time with Amtrak anyway.
Stop it. Quit now. Quit it with Amtrak. What's the date then again?
I'm traveling the 4th. We're doing the thing on the 5th, and I'm coming home on the 6th.
Oh, cool. Oh, that is so cool.
God willing, there will be no layovers in Guantanamo.
Oh, well, we can bail you out. speaking of that, Michelle mentioned last night or the night before that she said, or in chat or someplace, she said, I get to buy a piece of sheetrock. And I thought, she wanted her name on a piece of sheetrock in the Made in America studio.
Yeah.
And I thought, ooh, well, I can buy one board, too. That would be, you know, they can't be more than $12. That's probably $12.
And we'll write your name on it before we mud it and paint it.
Thank you. And then speaking of mud, then I wanted to offer to buy all the sandpaper that it's going to take to sand after you've done mudding. But that won't be very much because Wayne is going to teach the girls how to mud and tape. And then they will do it right, and there won't be an extreme amount of sanding to do.
Wayne will be thrilled to know that he's going to do that.
You just tell the boy to call me or email me or something. I think the girls should be taught a trade. They're not too young. We had 9- and 10-year-olds coming down to the Gulf Coast. They're coming down to from Ohio.
Yeah, they can see. They can mud and sand as high as they can reach.
And they can also stand on ladders.
And I can set up a little boom box, and we can play the Family Affair theme.
Whatever, I'm serious.
No, I am too. You think I'm kidding? I've got background music for everything.
Don't threaten me. I think this is an excellent opportunity to teach the girls how to mud and tape or tape and mud. And
ain't no harm in teaching the boy either.
Well, I figured he's a boy. He should know how to do that. Oh God. Anyway, I think this is an excellent opportunity to teach those kids a trade, and I wish I would teach them myself. And you just don't need a whole lot of sandpaper if you mud right.
I promise, though, I'm not turning them loose with a glue gun.
No.
Don't know that I've found a use for a glue gun yet, but I don't care. They're not getting loose with one.
I love it.
Mommy,
anyway,
I'm stuck to doodle and can't get loose.
It's your fault.
Dang, that stuff's hot.
Oh, God, I could go on with that. That's a good monologue. I just wonder, this is a good place to remind folks that the 20-something of January, and we still got a chance to just break Rick's bank and blow that man out of the water with our donations and stuff. So we need to put some sheetrock up and get the studio started. So I bet we're not close to $1,000 yet. So
getting closer.
Oh, that's good.
Almost there.
Almost to 1,000.
Haven't heard. Now, to be honest, I have not heard from Wayne in the mailbox lately.
The old Beckley mailbox.
Yeah, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia 25801. I haven't heard from Wayne. But so you know, we may be at 1,200 or 1,300 by now. I just don't know.
Well, that's good. We just need to keep the mics hot. So I just wanted to call in and say I get to buy a board and the sandpaper. So. And also I heard that they're not going to give those tax things, that money they're giving away. It's not even going to be here till May, so that's not going to do us any good to get into the studio.
No, it doesn't. But I still think we're onto something there. And, you know, we could have a wall of heroes. Hang an 8x10 color glossy photograph with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one. Of everybody who helps break Rick.
Hang it
in the studio. If I thought you guys would go for prayer hankies, we'd do those.
Okay. I guess folks are stacked up, and this is my cell phone high minute time, so I'm going to hang up. And I just wanted to thank you for the good show tonight and the good week and for doing the remote with a guy from D.C. That's just got to be a bear to be on the edge of your seat all the time waiting on something to go wrong.
Well, everything was teched out okay. It's just more a matter of time than anything else.
Yeah, I appreciate
we have that kind of a day on Mondays and Fridays when Dr. Bill's able to go. But not usually on a Thursday, and most of the time, at least to one extent or another, I can get a little help from Agnes, but things sort of, you know, this being a little bit of a special thing and, you know, being a remote and different circumstances, it was, you know, me.
Well, I want to thank you for the week. You guys.
Well, bless your heart. Thank you.
Really did a good job, and I love to hear you and John and Peter do cyber tech talk over the air. It's just so much fun.
Well, I hope it doesn't turn into too much inside baseball, but see, John has so much knowledge of this stuff that...
Oh, no, I'm serious. I don't know. I didn't know a lot of that stuff.
Well, I've always loved it, Kate, and I can't help but, I guess I transpose or transfer some of my fascinations onto the program, and you never hear anybody explaining how this stuff works. And when you've got a dummied up, ginned up, faked up, rubed up Dodge, it's nice if you've got, you know, somebody, well, just like with the mentalists and so forth, you've got the amazing Randy coming in and showing you how to bend the spoon. And so, you know, if somebody can explain how right-wing radio works, how they get rich, or how, you know, or how it becomes more likely that, yes, George Bush was getting prompted, or, you know, Romney's getting answers thrown to him, or someone else is, then I assume there's going to be some level of interest out there somewhere, and I also assume that if it's absolutely loathsome, somebody will, by God, tell me.
Yeah. We got to keep after him, Bob. I appreciate the work you guys all did this week. It was a good one. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you, and have a great weekend.
Thank you. Just hug the redhead for me, will you?
I sure will. I absolutely will. I'll tell her you said to. All right.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Onward as quickly as we possibly can. Hi, who have I got?
Me?
Oh, Nanette?
Yeah.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. I have one question.
All right.
I've done a lot of remodeling. What in the heck are you going to use a glue gun for?
I don't know, but, you know... If there's one within three counties, my kids will find it and glue themselves together.
Okay. But what I wanted to call about was Susan was talking about taking recordings of the blast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're noisy. But the noise is not what's bad. It's the feeling you get. You feel it from the inside if you're close enough.
Yeah,
the size of a bass drum.
Yeah, the way it rumbles your guts.
Yeah, all in your chest, all over your body. That's what a blast does to you. And it does your house the same way. It's just not the sound. It's what it makes you feel like.
Yeah, I know, and that's kind of what makes me wonder, Nanette, if we can make it real with something like a recording, but we can try.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, we've got fairly nice modern windows in the studio back here, and they're getting big enough that the window glass, you know, they're thermal panes, you know, and the window glass is kind of beginning to buzz a little bit when it happens.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I know all about it. But it's the feeling that is the bad part. It's not just the sound. It's irritating to hear a sound. But when you feel it, it's a sickening feel. It makes you feel sick.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And I don't know how to replicate that.
All we can do is replicate the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then we turn it over to John, and, you know, John makes it real.
But, you know, I was thinking...
You know, one thing we can do is when we play it, we can say, hey, everybody, turn your subwoofers up as loud as they'll go.
Yeah.
Get real close to them.
Okay, have you ever heard a car that's got, you know, the whole trunk full of this stuff and it's just, you know.
Yeah.
That's how it feels. Every time one goes off.
How many do you get a day, Nanette?
It varies. It really varies. But usually, around here, they usually put them off between 3:30 and 4:30 in the afternoon.
Is there any law behind it that says when they can and when they can't?
No, not that I know of, but I do know that they usually put them off after the DEP closes, and if you call in a report of an overblast, there's nobody there to take your call.
Then there is kind of a rule behind when they do and when they don't, isn't there?
I yeah. But another thing, if they put these seismographs on your property, watch them really closely. Because, like, you know, I tell you about the feel, how it makes you feel.
Mm-hmm.
They pack them with foam rubber.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I remember the dust collectors. I think it was Pauline talking about those.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. The dust collector that had a sealed lid on top of it.
Yeah. Uh huh. Yeah. So I mean, any way you go about it, they worm their way through it. But I don't know how in the world you can record the sound, but the effect of that sound you can't feel. Not on a recording.
Yeah, you know, I think we could probably do a little bit if folks have subwoofers, but yeah, I know what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I don't know, figure out a way to play it loud enough, you know, warn people and say, turn your speakers up really loud.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here's life.
Do what?
I said, and tell them, you know, turn your speakers up, here's life, you know, here really loud, you know, here's our life.
Uh-huh, yeah. The pictures rattle on the wall, the dishes rattle, you know, all that stuff. It's the feeling, it's the vibration of it, the concussion of it that gets you.
Yep.
So, that's
it. And, you know, when you're doing it to people, one of the things that is taken into account by the death scientists is the internal effects of a concussive blast.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you don't have to be burned up. You can be blown to bits just by the air wave.
Right. Uh-huh.
And that's some of what's reaching you there. How bad is it getting for you guys so far?
Well, they've not started really blasting back here yet, but you can hear the heavy equipment back there. They're cutting the road. You can hear the click, 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 you know, the
yeah.
Tracks on the bulldozers and all that.
Mm-hmm.
You can hear that. But they've not started blasting yet. I guess they're having to cut roads to get the drilling machines in. So
to drill the pack in the explosives.
Yeah. So, but they have to cut the roads first.
Good jobs for West Virginians. I know. Nanette, you and Paul have a wonderful weekend, as wonderful as you can,
too.
All right?
You too. You take care.
You too. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And let's see. Nope. And nope. Okay, so the phones are cleared, and that's pretty much the weekend. Go have a look at the book, and by the way, if you feel like treating yourself to an entertainment and an entertainment value, forego the movies this week and go and get Brighter Than Creation's Dark by the Drive-By Truckers. You will. I mean, if you like it now, I mean, you know, if feelings and You Light Up My Life are your cup of tea, you are not going to like it. On the other hand, if you like rock and roll, and you like, you know, Southern sound and rock and roll, and you like rock and roll with incredibly intelligent lyrics, you're going to like Brighter Than Creation's Dark. Promise. And, I don't know. Maybe, I think you can actually buy it through the trucker's website, drivebytruckers.com. Tell them where you came from. That'd be cool. Sitting here, putting the bite on you to contribute to the network and keep the lights on here and telling you to go out and buy other stuff. If that rubs against your grain, I apologize. But, you know, sometimes we had, just like what's coming up this weekend, the weekend lineup here on the Horn, the middle of which is Night Sounds with, what does Peter call him? The world's most fabulous straight guy, Billy Shears, who brings you Night Sounds every Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. It's a chance to get away. Chance to put some of the stuff aside. And, enjoy life. Yes, it is confirmed to me by the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio host, Peter Godbold, that yes, indeed, Billy Shears is the world's most fabulous straight guy. I didn't know there was balloting. I would have run for the position, but, you know, who the hell am I? Now, that's Peter's award. That's Peter's award to confer, and I tend to agree. Oh, okay, close call. Yeah, after the fact, Peter. But Peter is on his way with a Just Us edition of Strictly Confidential. No foxed up tonight, because it is, after all, John's weekend, and he's already put in some overtime. I'll have to pay him double this week. And no horn section, as for the same reason. Thank you all for a wonderful week. I look forward to another tremendous week next week. Join us over the weekend when everybody else is running reruns. We're running fresh programming. We have for you the Sourds Report. We have for you Night Sounds. And we have for you Rick's Place with horn psychotherapist and all-around great guy Rick Goodner. Join us in the chat room if you want to. That's a lot of fun. Any way you slice it, I think you'll have a blast. Probably shouldn't say blast. Many thanks to Peter Godbold, who is also our IT professional, to John Fox, who is, in fact, our incredibly talented engineer, who can engineer from 15,000 miles away or whatever it is. Many thanks to the hardest working man in liberal talk, Ben Birch, at WhiteRoseSociety.org. If you value what happens on the horn, you value WhiteRoseSociety.org. Endless eternal thanks to our partial sponsor, Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Coal River Mountain Watch. Are you a member? Good. If you're not a member, why not? Go and be a member. Be part of the solution. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Radio kids, it's time for Strictly Confidential.
It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome. Welcome to book, chapter, and verse 109 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network, and also brought to you by Coal River Mountain Watch. Their site is crmw.net. Please take a look and find out what's going on in West Virginia. Most of us have not a clue. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Friday, January the 25th, 2008. Let that be recorded as a day that Peter did not get a nap. This is important to listeners because they are aware that I am fairly cranky when I do not have a nap and am prone to email people prior to 9 a.m., which you really don't want to happen. So in any case, if you are listening on a Friday evening, which is January the 25th, 2008, shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time, you're indeed listening to a live show. You're welcome to phone in and participate. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on. That's 877-443-2366. That's toll-free. If you have unlimited long distance, please use that. You'll save the studio a nickel or a buck. Remember, we are listener-supported, so every bit helps. That telephone number is 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the mail during the breaks. Last evening, that would have been Thursday, I promised you that our guest this evening would be a Mr. Utley, and Justin Utley is his full name. Justin is an up-and-coming out gay musician and songwriter, and doesn't do dance music like we often do here. He's an entirely different genre. He's from Utah, amazingly enough, amazing young man. And we had to reschedule that. Justin will be with us this coming Wednesday evening, and that will be a show that you don't want to miss. He comes highly recommended by someone else who is interviewed on the show, and everything I can find out about Justin is just remarkable. So we'll be looking forward to that. So this evening is a Just Us show on the network. We'll be having music and news and callers and all kinds of interesting things. The show site, by the way, is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests as well as to the guests' websites. And you'll find links to audio archives from past shows. You'll find links to the chat room, which is active as I speak, and I do encourage you to go by there and stop in. You will find an amazing assortment of people. If you're kind of shy and don't feel like talking at first, you could just log in and what we call lurk. And that's fine. You're welcome to join us. That's the link will be at Strictly Confidential Radio.